Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, fueled as always by Hornady Ammunition, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad to be with you here in Alexandria, Virginia today. We've got a very busy show. Andrew Langer is going to join us from the Institute for Liberty later in the hour. Seton Motley of Less Government. Next hour, Jen Jake, Stephen Miller of Heat Street will tell you about the rest of the show a little bit later on. Right now, I want to bring in our friend from National Review, Mr. Jim Garrity is with us. Jim, how are you, sir?
Cam, good to be with you.
It's good to be with you as well. It's a little weird for me to be here and you not to be sitting right beside me, but I understand dadly duties have to be done, so I appreciate you spending a couple of minutes with us today. And you know, listen, Jim, let's get, I think, right to it. The shooting in Alexandria yesterday and the response that we've seen from both politicians, from pundits, but I want to start with the New York Times, if we can. Because
yeah.
The New York Times last
night... No, it's worth starting.
Yeah. Well, listen, the New York Times comes out with this editorial last night. There's a lot to unpack, and we're going to be talking about it throughout the afternoon. But the thing that immediately got noticed was the New York Times saying that Sarah Palin had inspired the killer in Tucson, Arizona, with this map featuring crosshaired targets of members of Congress. And in fact, the New York Times editorial said that there was more of a direct link to Sarah Palin and this killer in Tucson than anybody on the left and this guy in Alexandria yesterday, to which... it should be noted, not only did most folks on the right rise up with a, what the hell, but you had people on the left who noted this, including Chris Hayes from MSNBC. Look, this simply isn't true. Hours and hours and hours go by, and then a couple of hours ago, the New York Times puts out this tweet basically saying, oh, sorry, everybody. Thanks for telling us about our mistake. We've corrected it. As if that's it, Jim. So let's start there, because there's no way that editorial board of the New York Times put that in their editorial believing what they wrote was true. I cannot for the life of me believe that.
I was going to say, yesterday afternoon, after the events in Alexandria, passions are running high. And I got into an argument with a blogger who I think of as a friend and friendly acquaintance, and a guy who I usually am on the same page with, by the name of Ace of Spades. And he and I disagree pretty strongly on this. And my attitude is, look, I don't think that talk radio caused the Oklahoma City bombing. I don't think that heavy metal or violent video games caused the Columbine shooting. And I don't think that Sarah Palin's Facebook page caused the Tucson shooting. If I don't believe that in these outside factors, in these, you know, media, it's not really the shooter, it's the media that's the problem, mm-hmm. or talk radio that's the problem, or something like that. If I don't buy into that for, you know, when they try to pin this on the right, then I should not try to pin this on the left and say, aha, this shooter worked for Bernie Sanders, this is Bernie Sanders' fault. I have a lot of disagreements with Bernie Sanders, but I don't think at any point Bernie Sanders ever said anything that would make people say, yes, you should go out and shoot those people. Did his rhetoric in the middle overheated at times? Can we debate that? Yeah, sure. But I don't think it's fair to pin this more than it is to pin any of these other shootings to try to divert responsibility from the person who actually committed the crime. Ace's argument was, well, look, no, the folks on the left need to feel this. They need to feel unjustly accused. They need to feel like they're being smeared and having blood, you know, put on their hands. Unjustly and unfairly, so they'll know not to do it this time. I'm not quite convinced, but when the New York Times goes out and does something like this, and it makes, you know, brings up this argument that has pretty much been dispelled within a couple of days of looking into the Tucson shooter back in 2011, mm-hmm. right? This guy was a paranoid schizophrenic. He believed that grammar was part of a vast conspiracy. The guy was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. And so there was never any tie established to Sarah Palin or the Republican Party or anything on the right. And you and I remember this wasn't that long ago. We remember having the big memorial service and this big debate about whether political rhetoric had gotten overheated and the need for a new tone. The new tone lasted for about 5 minutes. And kind of the sense that somehow the New York Times either was oblivious to everything that had happened in the trial of the Tucson shooter and everything we had come to know about this guy, which in that case, it's inexcusable and you're too stupid and ignorant to write an editorial like that. Or you do know and you're going to lie about it because you want to score points against the other side. And it just feels so good to blame the political opposition for something they had nothing to do with. Those are both bad options. Stupid or malevolent. And it's up to people to kind of pick that. I'm glad they corrected it. I think I'd prefer more than an Emily Letella, oops, never mind type, response, and maybe a little bit more of a response of, you know, we just smeared somebody. Not only should we not have done that, here's how this happened and here's what steps we're taking to ensure this doesn't happen again.
That'd be a start. You're not likely to get it. You know, New York Times got rid of its public editor in the last round of layoffs. So who watches The Watchmen? Nobody's watching The Watchmen right now. And frankly, I think if it were not for that immediate outcry, including from some fellow members of the journalism fraternity, I don't think The New York Times would have corrected it. I don't think that they would have gone back and even did what they did. But, you know, you talk about your emotions yesterday and, you know, look, come on, we got to try to play fair and be nice. And yes, we do want one standard, but we want to be the good standard, the right standard for everybody. You know, I realized as I was reading that editorial last night for the New York Times that I've sort of been dealing with the five stages of grief here, just in terms of where we are as a nation. And I've been stuck in depression for a while, Jim. I've just been kind of depressed about where we're headed. Last night after reading that editorial, man, I reached acceptance. That was the wake-up call. That was the slap upside my head of, nope, you know what? We're going to have people who truly do believe that they are the epitome of journalism and that they are the creators of the ethics and the standards that the rest of the industry should use, and they will lie. They will lie flat out in order to try to score some cheap political points in order to make their team feel better. That's where we are with journalism right now. That's where we are with the culture. And I don't think there's a darn thing that any one of us can do to change it.
It does feel like – it feels like Sisyphus. It feels like you're trying to hold back the ocean with a bucket of water. The issue here is the question of you and I want one standard. And as I've said many times going back to this argument and from before, I could live very happily with a more polite, respectful, demure, less overheated world of political rhetoric. I could live in a more polite society very happily. Or I could live in one where no holds barred. It's kind of like the internet. Anybody can say anything they else. And it's, you know, Katie bar the door. We're just going to say whatever we want about each other without any consequence. I can live in either one of those worlds, but I want one standard. I want that one standard applied consistently and not one that says, well, people in my world get to say and do whatever they want, but people in your world have to be on their best behavior and things like that. In my dispute with Ace, I reject the idea that political rhetoric causes someone to commit a violent attack. I don't, unless it's the explicit, not just the legal standard, I think it is an excuse to say, oh, no, it was the rhetoric that made him do it. But the Ace argument is there's a good standard, which is what I would argue is there's a bad standard. If they want to apply the bad standard to us, we're going to apply the bad standard to you. My fear is that this means everybody accepts the bad standard. And if everybody accepts the bad standard that political rhetoric causes violence, my fear is that the next step will be, okay, now we have to limit political rhetoric. We have to limit the First Amendment. We have to limit freedom of speech because now we have this broad agreement that rhetoric leads to violence.
And I think that's a valid concern. And one of the things that we talked about yesterday, and again, I'll make this abundantly clear, the individual here is responsible for their actions. But you look at not only the actions that this individual undertook yesterday morning in Alexandria, Virginia, but you look at I was looking at this guy's Facebook page before it got locked down, and he'd been around since like 2013, and I went through several hundred of his posts, and Jim, they're all political. Most of them are reposts of memes from other sites, and there was one post in the dozens and dozens that I looked at. It was of a little girl, I imagine his granddaughter, and it was a just that one note of humanity. But the rest of the time, It was entirely political, not a lot of comments on his post, a couple of likes. He would belong to a group, I believe, called Terminate the Republicans, that had, I think, a total of 9 members that were cheering this guy's action yesterday. I heard an interview with Bill Ewell, the former mayor of Alexandria, who said that this guy used to hang out in the YMCA there in Alexandria, and Bill Ewell would see him, like, almost every day. And he was always on his laptop, Bill Ewell said, and just always, every day, for hours at a time, always on his laptop. And I thought to myself, nobody actually, like, he's just sitting there in the Y all day. Nobody's trying to engage this guy in conversation. I don't blame the atmosphere, but I think if you marinate 24 hours a day, if that becomes your life, and if you choose, again, to make that your life, and you forget about your family, you forget about your friends, you pull away and you just get into this a spiral where every image, every message that you're receiving is, you know, these people over here are traitors, these people over here are terrorists, these people over here are the worst. You're never getting any other message out there. I think it can have an influence. I don't think it's responsible, but I think it's supposed to have an influence, right? That's why people are putting these things out, because they're supposed to be able to influence other people.
I think that's a really fair point, Cam. And I think one of the things that, by the way, let's point out, if you marinate in that, it's not like somebody runs up to you, grabs you, and holds a computer screen to your face and makes you read something, right? This is a conscious choice. Now, we've all had times where we start looking around on Facebook or something like that, seeing which one of our old classmates have gotten fat, or how our exes have turned out, or something like that. And all of a sudden you look up, it's 3 a.m., right? You get onto Twitter, or we've all had times where social media can kind of suck you in. Having said all that, it's still a conscious choice. And I think you're right. There's something very revealing about that. If your Facebook feed is nothing but politics, and it's nothing but this relentless anger, right, and this constant demonization of the other side. I mean, as you're mentioning that, I got, you know, there's 9 members of that Terminate Republicans group. What are the other 8 up to right now? I kind of wonder if anybody's checked in on those folks or something like that. Is it, you know, you and I have talked about this oodles of times, this idea that, look, are those that we disagree with, they're the opposition, and we disagree really strongly with them. And we were willing to put in really strong efforts to make sure they do not get their ideas enacted into law and into policy. We'll campaign like heck against them. We will be, you know, it's strong. But at no point do we wish any of these people harm. The poor Media Matters person who is stuck watching us every single day, I hope that person has a good, long, happy life and hopefully finds a more satisfying job than this one. Because I can't imagine this is all that, you know, waiting for Jim and Cam to say something controversial. You know, they're going to get, they're probably getting rigor mortis sitting in there.
They'll try. Anyway, Jim, I know you got to get running, but I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is good as always.
Thank you, Cam.
Talking with you.
Thank you for working with my schedule. I'd say I dress nicely for you, but now I have to, be, completely appropriate in front of a crowd of fourth graders, and, see how that goes.
That's going to be difficult for you. Well, good luck. We'll talk to you soon.
Good day to be talking in front of a bunch of kids, all right?
Jim Garrity, you can find him on Twitter when he is not entertaining fourth graders, at Jim Garrity. You can read him at National Review. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty is going to join us here in just a couple of minutes. Also, a Seton Motley of Less Government. As I mentioned, next hour, Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms, talking about some of the latest Second Amendment news around the country, including, I want to talk with Jen about The View, because The View was talking about the Second Amendment today. And Cameron, anytime The View talks about the Second Amendment, you know it's going to be good.
I mean, sometimes when I miss the show and I want to get the best Second Amendment news information, I turn on The View. So, yes.
There's like, it's Antonin and Scalia, it's Wayne LaPierre, it's Chris Cox, it's Cam and Company, and then it's The View. And maybe The View is a little bit higher. Who knows? I might not be going just in actual order. So, yeah, fascinating conversation. We'll talk about that with Jen Jakes next hour. Stephen Miller of Heat Street, who was a little incensed last night, as a lot of folks were, when that New York Times editorial dropped. And again, hours and hours, and there were people wondering, okay, when are they going to take it down? When are they going to correct it? Mid-morning today, they issued this correction. And we'll talk about this with Andrew, because we got to take a timeout. But that was half of the New York Times editorial. was the, oh, you know, it's bad. Yes, it's bad what happened here, but don't forget that the right has enabled and egged this stuff on for years and years. The other half of the editorial was just as bad. The New York Times editorial, was this attack evidence of how readily available guns and ammunition are in the United States? Indisputably, they said. Now, of course, they also said that indisputably Sarah Palin was responsible for the attack in Tucson, Arizona. So take your indisputable facts from the New York Times with several boulder-sized grains of salt. The Times editorial, Mr. Hodgkinson, by definition, should not have had a gun, but he was licensed in his home state, Illinois. And in any event, they write, it would have been easy for him to acquire a weapon in Virginia, which requires no background checks in private sales, requires no registration for most weapons, and has few restrictions on open carry. They just kind of blow right by the Illinois gun laws. Did you notice that? They'd much rather talk about Virginia's gun laws, where the guy was not a resident, where the crime took place, where, by the way, laws were broken. We don't have reciprocity with Illinois. I got actually, you know, I need to check on that. But I don't think we have reciprocity with Illinois, because I don't think Illinois recognizes Virginia's concealed carry license. Mr. Hodgkinson should not have had a gun, according to the New York Times. But they don't say what law you could put in place that would have prevented him from having a gun. He had a lot of run-ins with the law. But you know what he never had? And this is kind of important. He never had a conviction. We're going to talk about this afternoon, because this is one of the other pieces of this story that the media is happy to blow right by in their zeal and their desire to say, well, we need some kind of gun law here. I mean, look at this guy's criminal record. Yeah, he had a lot of arrests. Why isn't anybody asking why this guy never actually went to trial on any of these domestic violence accusations? Because they all got dismissed. And, you know, it's kind of hard to deny people their rights when they've not been convicted of a crime. Also, if your answer to violent crime is we need more laws, I think you'd be a little bit interested about why the laws that are currently on the books apparently are not being enforced, why charges are getting dismissed against people who are alleged to have committed acts of violence. But they don't want to talk about that. We're going to talk about it. We're going to take a time out first, though, when we come back. Andrew Langer with the Institute for Liberty. Stick around. Just getting started here on this Thursday edition of Cam and Company.
I'm speaking with Emily Mead with NRA Hunters for the Hungry. Emily, welcome. Tell me, what is NRA Hunters for the Hungry?
Well, NRA Hunters for the Hungry is a program that originally started back in 1993. And it is a way for hunters to either donate their protein or their time for a great cause.
That's a great idea. Why did NRA get involved with this? Why did they think it was important to do this?
NRA got involved because they were looking for an option for hunters to give back to their community and something to help everyone at large. So this program allows you to do that. By donating the protein from your animals, it goes to either food, shelter, or it goes to shelters or food banks or churches or people in need in general.
That's great. So tell us a little bit, how does it work? How does a hunter walk us through either donate his their protein or their time?
Currently, we have a fabulous website. And by going there, there's a Get Involved tab. And once you go there, we have a geotagged map on the website, which will put you in contact with a processor near you, as well as a taxidermist, if that's something you're interested in. As for donating your time, we also allow you to contact us, and we can put you in contact with the affiliate program that is closest to you.
Awesome. Speaking with Emily Mead with NRA Hunters for the Hungry. And, Emily, how do we get more information about the program?
To get more information about the program, you can either go to our website, which is huntersforthehungry.nra.org, or you can email us at hservices@nrahq.org, or you can even call at 1-800-492-4868.
Emily Mead, NRA Hunters for the Hungry, thank you for what you do. Thanks for what the NRA does. This is great stuff, and thanks for being on the program.
We're here in Las Vegas, Nevada, SHOT Show 2017, and it is really an honor to be here with McKenna Dahl of USA Shooting. It is so good to see you, McKenna.
Thank you.
So you are, for people who don't know, and you know this, I can't imagine there are people who don't know, you are the first Paralympian to win a medal in shooting at the Olympics, correct?
First female, yes.
First female, all right. Talk about that.
I just thought it was absolutely amazing to be able to represent the United States in USA Shooting so well on the world stage and really show females that we can go after whatever we want to.
Now, what was your event?
I shoot in SH2 prone and standing.
Okay. So when you were, and this was at the Rio Games.
It was.
In 2016. You see it, of course, everyone watches the Olympics, and then at the end you get the medal ceremony, and you see the people, and they play all the anthems, and you're up there. And, you got bronze, so they didn't play your anthem, but you're up there representing the country. And so what does that feel like, just to stand there and know that the United States of America, you're representing this amazing country down in Rio?
It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Yeah. I didn't get to hear the anthem, but I did get to see the flag raised, and my parents were able to attend my match.
Oh,
so
cool.
They were there in the stands, crying, cheering, and it was phenomenal. There's almost not even words to describe the entire experience.
Absolutely. So how old are you now?
I'm 20.
Okay, and when did you start shooting?
I started shooting, I tried it for the first time when I was 12.
Okay.
Traveling internationally, I was 15 or 16.
Okay. What condition do you have, and how do you work around it when it comes to shooting? Because it's obviously, for a lot of people, it's hard to shoot as they are. I'm the worst shot in the world. But for you, what condition it makes it harder for you to do it, and what workarounds do you use?
I have arthrogryposis, which is the loss of muscle and contracture of joints at birth.
Okay.
Birth is the worst it'll ever be. I can only improve what I have from here.
Is it? Oh, wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
That's because usually you hear it the other way.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Good. Okay.
Yep.
Welcome back to Cam and Company on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. We have Chief Motley of Less Government coming up later on in the hour. Next hour, Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms will be with us. Andrew Lager from the Institute for Liberty joins us on the program right now. Andrew, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing great, Cam. Glad to be here today.
I'm glad that you could join us. We've been talking about the New York Times editorial, some of the media reaction. And I'm going to tell you, Andrew, I'll give you another little aside here. So I'm driving home last night, getting ready to pack up and head up to Alexandria, and I'm listening to SiriusXM Patriot. I'm listening to SiriusXM POTUS. I'm listening to SiriusXM Progress. And it came in at like the last half hour of the Michael Signorelli show. Michael Signorelli wasn't even talking about the shooting on SiriusXM Progress. He was talking about Jeff Sessions testifying the day before yesterday.
Sure, because why would they talk about the biggest story of the day?
Sure, right? Then Dean Obadala comes on, and he's talking with Karen Hunter, who's a host from SiriusXM Urban. And, Andrew, I was really struck by, just the jocularity that folks were – the hosts were showing. They're laughing with each other. They're joking with each other. They're yelling at conservative callers who called in. Listen to a little bit later, the Young Turks laughing and joking around. Meanwhile, over on SiriusXM Patriot 125, it's a very serious – presentation. People are getting updates and giving updates about Steve Scalise and in his medical condition. It was so fascinating, just the difference in tone for what was, I think, a very serious day. And I think that there were a lot of people on the progressive side of the political spectrum who frankly aren't taking this very seriously.
Well, let me just take a slightly different tack on this, Cam, because I think that they recognize how serious this is, and they don't want to acknowledge it, because acknowledging that this is serious means that they have to acknowledge their culpability, which sort of gets into the New York Times attempt to deflect away from all of this, right? I mean, and let's not understate this, because the attack yesterday, I'm not going to say it's the most serious terrorist attack ever in U.S. history, but let's make it really clear here. The third ranking member of the Congressional Majority Party there was an assassination attempt on him yesterday. And Republicans in the House, there was an assassination attempt on them yesterday. And so this was a very serious political attack that was ideologically driven. And there's no way to deny it. I mean, obviously there are folks who are going to try to deny it, and the left's way of trying to do it is to ignore it. But the reality is, they have culpability in all of this. And this is why the New York Times deflection aside, here's what I keep coming back to. This is the logical end result of a couple of different things. It's the dehumanization of the opposition party. Mm-hmm. It is the constant stream of imagery by the left that sort of says that anybody who is a Republican is open to attack, especially if they're the president of the United States. It is the end result of not extremists, but mainstream leftist media people adopting and promoting the idea that punching a Nazi is okay, right? Or, and more to the point, right? Because let's distinguish between the Indiana Jones, Captain America Nazi punching of legitimate Nazis. And remember that the left considers anyone who doesn't agree with them to be a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's such a blanket generalization here as to make it. And then we get to the point where, remember, conservative speech is a form of violence, therefore it must be suppressed. But leftist violence is a form of speech that is legitimate. I mean, that's the weird mental gymnastics that their side is doing. And yesterday's attack is a natural outcropping of that.
Unfortunately, I think that you're right. And I want to explore this a little more, because when you talk about culpability, you're not taking any responsibility for this attack away from the individual who committed this attack. But it sounds like what you're talking about again is the fact this guy was marinating in this. He was steeped in this. This was the message that he was getting all day long. If you look at his Facebook feed, this is the only thing that he's regurgitating, are these types of, messages. And, you know, you talk about the punch a Nazi, moment or the movement. Who was it who one of the award show talked about, punching people in the face and got a rousing round of applause? For that, I can't remember. It was earlier this year during one of the awards. I think it was the director of Stranger Things.
I know that Keith Olbermann was on the Bill Maher show talking about how, you know, to punch Richards. And nobody, listen, Cameron Gray and I were at CPAC. We were appalled when we saw Richard Spencer show up. It was Richard Spencer who showed up at the bar one night. We were appalled at this. We were trying to figure out what best to do about it. Keith Olbermann to go out there and sort of talk about the fact that, you know, this wasn't gratuitous violence to punch this guy in the face. What I'm talking about here is, obviously, you know, you don't condone and you don't say that James Hodgkinson is not guilty. But what has happened in America is that if you are on the left, you are being told time and again, culminating, of course, in the Julius Caesar production over the weekend of Shakespeare in the Park, you are being told that political violence of the left against the right is okay. Right? That's why there's this false equivalency between the rhetoric on the right. Nowhere on the right is anybody saying that political violence of right against left is condoned. No one's saying that.
Well,
but the converse is certainly the case.
And again, you know, go back to the Tea Party versus the
exactly.
Resistance, right? The what did the Tea Party do? The Tea Party threw tea in Boston Harbor as a rejection of a monopoly that the British government, that their government had imposed on them. And so that was their sort of, you know, bleep you, mother country, bleep you, Parliament. We're standing up for ourselves. And this is why you have people on the left say, well, it's okay for us to destroy Starbucks, right? Because, I mean, look at the Boston Tea Party. I don't think Starbucks is the issue, but okay. But now you look at the resistance. And what is the resistance? The resistance is resistance to tyranny. The resistance is resistance to oppression, to an occupying and illegitimate government, right? I mean, it conjures up those images of the French resistance punching Nazis, you know, and targeting Nazis. And again, Andrew, I'd say it comes from a very different place, and I think it comes from a much more inherently violent place than the
exactly.
Tea Party movement did.
And I agree with you wholeheartedly there. And let's take another angle to this too, right? Which is to say that in terms of the left, they're people for the most part for whom ideology is their faith. And if you do not agree with their ideology, that makes you an immoral or amoral person. And so therefore there is an element of religious fervor and therefore religious violence to all of this. I mean, it all goes hand in hand. I mean, I'm telling you, man, I was upset. I was obviously praying for Scalise, and I have friends who are friends with Matthew Micah, who was the lobbyist who was seriously injured in all this. Mm-hmm. But I was truly frightened by what happened yesterday, because it really, to me, this is not the end. This is not going to be an isolated incident, especially if the iconography of the left, which sends people the message that this sort of thing is okay, right, despite what Nancy Pelosi and Bernie Sanders have to say, and I appreciate that they went out there and condemned it in the strongest terms possible. But this guy was not getting his cues from Nancy Pelosi or you know, Bernie Sanders to an extent.
Right.
He's getting it from the Rachel Maddows and the Keith Olbermans of the world.
You know, I was thinking yesterday, Andrew, about John Brown back in the 1860s, yeah. Right? The anti-slavery a zealot who, you know, you're looking back on history, right? This guy was on the right side of history. He hated slavery, an ardent abolitionist. Now he murdered people in Kansas, and he, you know, took over the armory there at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, at the time Harper's Ferry, Virginia. And when he took over with his buddies that armory at Harper's Ferry, like, that was one of those moments where, again, the politicians on both sides, they were all very careful to say, oh, this is horrible, this is horrible. And then he became a hero. Right. He became a martyr. You know, the song Battle Hymn of the Republic. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. That was actually a tune called John Brown's Body. John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave. And that's what the Union soldiers would sing to as they, you know, were marching the early days of the war. A guy went from being a terrorist to being a hero and to being a martyr. Or, you know, the public opinion of what this guy did changed in a very short amount of time. And, you know, again, we did see, Andrew, I think a pretty disturbing amount of people yesterday who were not expressing any sort of remorse. They were not expressing any sort of grief. They weren't saying, oh, this is horrible that this has happened. They were saying, yeah, you know what? These guys got what was coming to them.
Well, and certainly when you then turn around and you use it for your political, your various parochial political causes. I mean, I'm sure you guys have and are going to, you know, go into Terry McAuliffe in depth today.
Oh, yes.
But that's exactly it, though. I mean, it is, you know, it is the immediate reaction, right? The denial of reality. You know me. I mean, I tend to come at these things from a place of real, I'm not going to say that I'm a thoughtful person, but I try not to sort of fly off the cuff. Once this gentleman was identified yesterday and his ideology was made clear, I felt no compunction against saying something about it. And I got immediate pushback from people I know who are on the left telling me that I was doing a disservice because I was bringing up this ideology. No, this person was ideologically driven. And we have to make it clear that this was an ideologically motivated attempted massacre. And that this is not acceptable in this society. And that in that way, we need to put the left on the defensive with regards to what they are trying to do in America today.
Talking again with Mr. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty, at Andrew_Langer on Twitter. Andrew, thank you, sir, for your time, and hope we get a chance to talk again soon.
Always, Cam. Look forward to it.
All right, man. We'll see you soon. Andrew Langer joins us here on Cam & Company. Only have a few minutes left here before we need to take a timeout. Seton Motley of Less Government going to join us. But back to this New York Times editorial, if we can. I mentioned there's a lot to unpack here. Was this attack, they write, evidence of how readily available guns and ammunition are in the United States? Indisputably, they say. Again, they don't say what gun law could have been put in place that would have stopped Mr. Hodgkinson from obtaining a firearm legally in Illinois, which he did, because he was not a prohibited person. Again, if you want to talk about where maybe mistakes were made, maybe where the law failed, well, okay, let's look at the fact that this guy had multiple charges, multiple cases against him, dismissed in court in at least one case because a witness failed to show up to testify. Apparently there was some confusion about what day the witness needed to be there, and the judge dismissed the case rather than continue the case over. Let's talk about what's going on in our criminal justice system. If you're going to say, well, this guy shouldn't have been able to legally buy a gun, all right, well, based on this guy's arrest record, based on the lack of convictions, what law would you suggest we put in place? Or can we actually talk about the failures in the system right now? I know it's so much easier to simply say all we need is to put another law on top of the ones that we have, and that will make everything better. It's easy to say that. It's just not true. The New York Times says, the reaction of some was that the only solution is yet more guns. Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama, who is among those who came under fire on Wednesday, said it's not easy to take when you see people around you being shot and you don't have a weapon yourself. New York Times editorial board says that's an entirely reasonable reflex. All people in that situation, unarmed and under fire, would long to be able to protect themselves and their friends. Yet they say, consider the society that Americans would have to live in, the choices that they would all have to make to enable that kind of defense. Every member of Congress, they write, and every other American of whatever age would have to go to the baseball practice or to school or to work or to the post office or to the health clinic or to any of the other places where mass shootings now take place with a gun on their hip. And then, they write, when an attack came and they returned fire, they would probably kill or wound not the assailant but another innocent bystander, as studies have repeatedly shown. First of all, what they're describing doesn't exist in New York City, but it exists in many states around the country, where you have people who are legally and lawfully carrying wherever they go. Not everybody does that. And despite what the New York Times writes, I don't know of anybody who would demand that every American out there carry a firearm, regardless of whether or not they wanted to. But I know millions of Americans who say, you know what? If I decide to exercise my right to bear arms, that's my decision to do so. As a legal, law-abiding American, someone who's not a prohibited person, if I make that decision and I reach that conclusion, then I'm going to do it. And it's not up to the New York Times. It's not up to Terry McAuliffe. It's not up to Nancy Pelosi or Dianne Feinstein to say, no, you can't. It's not your right. New York Times says, when an attack came, they returned fire. They would probably kill or wound not the assailant, but another innocent bystander, as studies have repeatedly shown. They don't cite these studies. They don't tell us where we can find them. They just say that they've repeatedly shown this. Well, you know, we have a segment every day on this program called The Hero of the Day, Armed Citizen Stories. Many, not all of them, involving concealed carry holders. And I got to tell you, it's pretty rare to find that story of a concealed carry holder able to defend themselves or another. And you know what? They're just firing willy-nilly, hitting everybody around them but their attacker. It doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. But the New York Times would rather deal in the hypotheticals than in reality. Okay, we got to take a time out. When we come back, Seton Motley of Less Government joins us. Stick around. We have much more Cam and Company still to come right after this.
I'm here with Christina Krawczyk with NRA Foundation, Anthony Brewer with Greystone Marketing, and his nephew, Glenn Brewer. Thanks for being with us here. And Christina, we're talking about NRA Foundation. Let's start with you. Why is NRA Foundation so important? What does it do, and how do you do it?
The NRA Foundation supports NRA programs and on local, state, and national programs. So like Women on Target, Eddie Eagle, School Shield, YHEC, Youth Education Summit. That money is produced with the foundation, and the blockbuster fundraiser behind that is Friends of NRA. So Friends of NRA has been around for 25 years. It's a milestone year.
Powerhouse.
At Powerhouse, blockbuster, we've got 53 field reps that produce over 1,100 events across the country. They raise about $65 million a year. Now, this is a milestone year, 25 years. So in that time, we've raised almost $750 million to support programs. So it's
amazing.
Incredible, really incredible.
All right. So and a lot of that happens with, you know, auctions, fundraisers, things like that. And I know people, they work tirelessly around the country to do these type of events. And we have with us Anthony Brewer with Greystone Marketing. So tell us a little bit about Anthony and what he did.
So, and you're exactly right. It takes like 15,000 volunteers across the country to put these on. So this year, we always have like a big sponsor showcase item. And this year, Diamondback Airboats produced this incredible airboat, the Diamondback NRA Airboat. Oh. What they wanted to do is kind of produce something that was, an adventure and looked like a stealth airplane. So we've had that on GunBroker for several weeks to raise money again for the foundation and the future of the shooting sports. And Anthony is our huge high bidder. He's wonderful. He loves the foundation, what it stands for, the cause, and we are just so thrilled to have him. And I know he's excited to get on that airboat.
Anthony, thank you so much. Why was it important to do what you did, to bid on this airboat for the foundation?
Well, the airboat itself was built less than 30 miles from our home, from our office. So the synergy was there. Absolutely. I know nothing about airboats. I've never been on an airboat. But Bob from...
I bet you're going to now.
Absolutely.
Bob, it just looked cool.
Well, it looks cool, but Bob from Diamondback bent over backwards to accommodate the... throughout the building process, we had our eye on it from when first time we heard about it.
Wow.
And what we want to do with it is utilize it for future opportunities for the NRA Foundation, not only to raise more funds, but safety awareness. Where Central Florida is, you know, it's Gator Country. So, you know, what better way than to, you know, come up with some NRA opportunities and hunts for the future generations and, you know.
Awesome.
There's a lot of different opportunities out there. So it's important that way.
And Glenn, I bet you can't wait to get on that boat.
I can't wait.
Are you going to be the pilot? Who's going to drive the airboat?
All I'm going to do is I'm just going to ride it. Just enjoy the breeze.
Ride it and go after the gators. All right, so we know, you know, the boat's cool and it's awesome, but there's more than that there, Anthony. You know, supporting why it's so important that you supported the NRA Foundation. You know, because it's not, that's a lot of money, let's be honest.
It's a lot of money, but it transcends just our freedoms and our Second Amendment and our support and, you know, the monumental feat that was accomplished in November. Now it's time to look forward to education and opportunity for, you know, what NRA does with the Boy Scouts and the educational and the safety and gun awareness. My nephew just turned 18, and this is a big opportunity for him to embrace what the NRA does beyond just, you know, Second Amendment. I mean, that's one of our most important fundamental opportunities. But
so what do you like about being able to shoot and to hunt and all that kind of stuff, Glenn?
Honestly, when I have the firearm, it just teaches me the right way to use it and safety and knowing how to operate it.
It's cool, right? And I tell people that. The shooting sports and hunting, there's so much more than just being a good shot. You learn that. You learn safety. You learn discipline. You learn so many things. There's you know, so many different benefits to it. All right, Christina, back to you.
Yes.
How do we get more information about the NRA Foundation and your very important work?
NRAfoundation.org. Everything that you need to find out. You're looking for grants, information about how you can raise money and donate to the cause, NRAfoundation.org, or you can follow us on Facebook.
Christina Krawczyk, Anthony Brewer, Glenn Brewer, thank you all for supporting the NRA Foundation, and thanks for being on NRA TV.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on SiriusXM Patriot 125 and NRA TV. Next hour, Jim Jakes of Bearing Arms, Stephen Miller from Heat Street right now. From Les Government, right in at redstate.com, Mr. Seton Motley on Twitter, at Seton Motley. Seton, good Thursday to you.
Yeah, how are you, sir?
I am good. I appreciate very much your column at Red State. When I saw the words Walter Durante, I knew that you had hit a home run.
Yes, the Pulitzer Prize winning liar for the New York Times.
Yes, who back in the early 30s wrote in the pages of the New York Times, no, there's no famine going on in the Ukraine. Yeah.
But keep in mind, this guy was the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times.
Oh, I know.
He was there.
He was there.
And he wrote and said there was no famine going on while 10 million people were starving to death.
Not only was he there, he was one of the few journalists who actually got to go to the Ukraine. And then he came back and reported, well, look, there are people dying of malnutrition, but there's no famine. Nobody's dying of starvation.
They're eating food. It's just it's Twinkies and Ho-Hos.
Yeah. Ended up winning the Pulitzer for this.
Yes,
for lying.
For lying his face off.
And,
and of course, there's a quote I put in the piece of Stalin praising his reporting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's a great book. I don't know if it's still in print, but it was written by Eugene Lyons. It's called Assignment in Utopia. And Lyons was a foreign correspondent in Moscow for about 6 years at the same time Durante was there. And it's absolutely fascinating how Durante, he actually, there's a story in there that Durante had a car horn. He had a car, first of all, which was kind of rare for Moscow at the time. But he had a car horn put in that was the same sound that the NKVD, the secret police, used. And he would drive up to people's, to friends' homes late at night, and he would honk the horn. And they thought, oh, my God, they've come for us.
Here, here.
That was his sick, twisted joke. I mean, that's who Walter Durante was, the New York Times columnist. And again, the lies of the New York Times go back decades. I think even the depravity and the depth to which the maliciousness of some of these reporters and editorial writers of the New York Times goes back decades. And it was on full display last night when, you know, 6 years after the attack in Tucson, Arizona, the New York Times decides to once again blame Sarah Palin for the attack at that supermarket that injured Gabby Giffords and killed so many others.
You know, what happened was, just to refresh people, this idiot Jarrett Loughner, who was clearly insane. I mean, not even, look, compared to this guy yesterday, this Loughner was insane. This guy seems really somewhat rational and reasonable, despite the fact that he just shot up a baseball game. But Loughner's just completely insane. What little political inclination he exhibited was leftist. And the media's theme that immediately came out was, Sarah Palin has a website with targeted districts, and the targeted districts have crosshairs on them, and one of the targeted districts is Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot and wounded at this place where six other people died by this idiot Jarrett Loughner. And because of this website, and I'm screaming at my television 6 years ago, the chances of this guy looking at Sarah Palin's website was 1,000,000,000,000 to 1. There is no way Jared Loughner was perusing the Sarah Palin congressional target website list.
And if he was, he was looking for grammar, right? Because that was what was his big complaint, apparently, was that grammar and words were being changed and used.
Right.
Right, because he had severe mental illness. But according to the New York Times, again, there was a clear link, right, between Palin
and the
this
reason
attack.
It was so it's so egregious now is it was very quickly debunked six years ago, and just late last night, the editors in total at the New York Times wrote that this was the truth as gospel in this op-ed about the shooting at the baseball practice. Like it never was debunked and hasn't been debunked for 6 years. And that's just offensive and stupid and obnoxious. And again, I would say their language about, you know, Sarah Palin is more insightful than anything the Republicans have said. But, you know, that's just me. And it's just, it's insane. It's the New York Times is just a ridiculous publication. And I'm telling you, I go back 20 plus years ago, I was an intern at CBS News in Washington.
Yeah.
And you've heard this on Limbaugh, and it's true. They would tear New York Times stories out, hand them to reporters, and go do this, go shoot this. So the New York Times is the model for the rest of the media.
It is.
And this is who we're dealing with.
And here's the thing. You know, we've been talking about this editorial, but as you point out in your column at Red State, this goes to the reporting, too.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so there was a story, and I actually read this story about EpiPens.
Yes.
And it was one of those stories that was designed to make you angry. It was meant to make you angry at the makers of EpiPen because, damn it, you know, they're still charging people all this money. The person who wrote the story said, you know, it was supposed to go down in price, and I still had to pay $609 for a box of two EpiPens. And as you point out, or Reason Magazine pointed out, 26 paragraphs into the story, the reporter discloses, in fact, the company says since it came under attack in August, nearly 90% of EpiPen buyers have paid less than $100 per box because of insurance discounts or coupons. And the Times story never talked about why this individual's
the first three quarters of the story were a lie.
Exactly. And
yes.
To make things worse, the story doesn't go into, okay, well, why, if 90% of the people are paying less than $100, why is the writer paying $600? Right.
And it's because, and I go into this a little more actually than Reason Magazine did, which is he's going through his insurance. and the writer at Reason got $100 because he's paying himself. And these people who, you know, this is the failing of the third party payer. When you've got two people in a room negotiating a price and the person who's paying it isn't in the room, the price is going to explode. Because you don't care. What do you care? It's not your money. But then you care later on, 6 months later, when your insurance premiums go up because you're paying exorbitant fees that you shouldn't have paid. So, yeah, I mean, it was a complete hit job on the EpiPen company specifically, but on prescription items in total, right? It was an assault on the prescription industry for allegedly overcharging. And you know, I'd already written 1,000 pages. You don't even go into, the second EpiPen costs, you know, $50. The first one costs $2 billion because of all the research and the failings and the money it costs to get approved by the FDA. So they got to make up that money, and that's where the margins come in. But it's completely absurd that this article was written this way. Like you said, a news article, not an opinion piece.
Right.
That is designed not to inform, but to misinform and to enrage.
But, you know, I think we've seen that when it comes to the gun industry. As well, particularly over the last couple of days, see, I can't put any stories in the New York Times in particular, but I have seen those stories about, actually, I take that back. Jonathan Martin at the New York Times tweeted last night amazement that more Republicans, that no Republicans had changed their mind about gun control after the shooting. Just absolutely befuddled as to why that was.
You know what I was pleased to see? Was more cojones on the part of Republicans. The New York Republican, whose name escapes me, said, man, I'm going to start carrying my gun now.
I think it was Representative Collins.
That's it. I mean, that's more spine than Republicans usually show after incidents like this. Where he said, you know, I got my permit, but I don't carry it in D.C. I'm going to start carrying it. I mean, that's good. That's the response we should have. And I'm hoping this pries open the stupid city council in D.C. It's Northern Virginia, too, but these guys work in D.C., obviously, to loosen these stupid restrictive gun laws they have on people.
I hope so as well. Seton, listen, I do appreciate you coming on the program, sir. And, again, great column at Red State.
I appreciate that, sir. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. We'll talk again soon. Seton Motley, at Seton Motley on Twitter. But, yeah, I saw this going around about, even this attack in Alexandria is not enough to change the minds of people like James Langford, who've gotten X number of dollars from the NRA over the years. Igor Volsky at Guns Down was tweeting out a series of those yesterday, and then I think a columnist kind of picked up and ran with that idea. As if the only thing, again, that's that makes these politicians support their right to keep and bear arms is the campaign contributions of the NRA. If those went away, then their mind would change like that, apparently. Would they say that same thing about the gun control advocates who get money from Michael Bloomberg? Of course not. Of course not. Those are going to be deeply held beliefs, commonsensical beliefs, right? Just a few commonsensical changes that we can make, and then everybody will be safer. They're never going to accuse politicians who support gun control of just being in it for the Bloomberg bucks. But, like, that's their go-to argument for politicians who actually support the right to keep and bear arms. I got to tell you, and you know this as well, if you've got a pro-gun member of Congress, you know they're not there because, the NRA supports us financially, and so therefore I support the right to keep and bear arms. They understand that right for themselves. They certainly understand how important that right is for their constituents. Alex Pappas reporting that Kentucky Representative Thomas Massie introducing a bill where anybody with a concealed carry permit in their home state could use that permit in Washington, D.C. I believe that Eleanor Holmes Norton has already blasted Representative Massie for this. But you know, we are going to continue to have these conversations. And frankly, you know, again, in the editorial in the New York Times today, America's Lethal Politics, we hear about how, you know, oh, Sarah Palin was to blame for that attack in Tucson. And, oh, some people just want to carry more guns around. That's not the world we want to live in, says the New York Times. They have They've got room for their diagnosis of the problem that we're facing as a country. But they ran out of room, Cameron, before they got to the solution. It's weird. Like, they had all this column about it. Here's what's wrong. And right. then they just forgot to put in the part about it. Here's how to fix things.
Yeah. It's a pattern, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And so, again, I'm trying to figure out, like, what are they calling for? Do we refer back to that front page editorial from the New York Times, the second one since the 1920s, where they said, listen, we just got to ban a whole bunch of guns. A whole bunch of guns that a lot of people own, we got to ban them, and we're going to have to get them off the streets, we're going to have to round them up, we're going to have to collect them. Is that still what they're calling for? Is that still what they want? They just, again, it doesn't work with the whole gun safety narrative, so they can't say that anymore. I have seen more columns over the past 24 hours talking about the need for a debate on guns that don't actually say anything. I have seen more columns about the, can we finally talk about guns? And the entire column is about why we need to talk about guns rather than actually them talking about guns. Because I don't think they know what they want. Well, I take that back. I think they know what they want. I don't think they know how to get what they want. All right, stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's coming up right after this. Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms, Stephen Miller of Heat Street, more of the day's top stories. It's all on the way right after this.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here in Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be, because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum. And you can tell by when you first walk in this place, if you look up and you're surrounded by fans, the track is so banked and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There's an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people. It's the last great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why they say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know, you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people and make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, won the race, finish second, third,
And we've also, as a car owner, loaded three of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine at Bristol. Now I look back and think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback, whatever you say.
You know, I had put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we were in victory lane. Go up that hill, I get to do a burnout on the way up. You know, all the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. A lot of these fans here in Bristol, they were cheering loud over there as the front stretch and burning it down. Hopefully we can do something like this come tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Back, hour two of Cam and Company starts right this second. We've got Jin Jakes of Varian Arms coming up on the program this hour. Also, Stephen Miller of Heat Street talking about the media reaction to the shooting in Alexandria yesterday. David Ersani at the Federalist joins us next hour as well. Says if the Alexandria shooter alone is responsible for his actions, then that standard should always apply. And of course, again, when it comes to the dominant narrative in the legacy media, that, of course, is not the case, right? These things are determined on a case-by-case basis. And if the left believes that hay can be made with the background or the ideology of an attacker, then they will definitely talk about the background of the attacker. If they can't, if they don't want to, if it makes them uncomfortable to talk about the background of the attacker, then they won't. Oftentimes, they'll talk about the background of the victims. Oftentimes, they'll then talk about social issues. They'll bring in guns, unless a truck or a knife was used, in which case they'll talk about how thankful they are that a truck or a knife was used and how we still need to work on gun control. I mean, we've seen how this works, right? You almost, like, go down a list here of, okay, if this, then that. If that, then this. And here's how to avoid talking about stuff you want to avoid talking about if you are a member of the press. David Ersani, as I mentioned, coming up in Hour 3. Sean Davis of the Federalist. Joining us in Hour 3 as well. Plus, we have today's Hero of the Day. We have the Deal of the Day. We have the Good Guy of the Day. And we've got Cameron Gray here today, who is actually not supposed to be. You're like the clerk in Clerks. You're like Dante. You weren't even supposed to be here today.
That's right. No, I wasn't. But I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad that you're here as well. And how are things in Del Rey? I mean, this is your neighborhood.
It is.
And I can't imagine that things have gotten anywhere close to back to normal. I saw Hannity did his show from Del Rey last night. Yes. He didn't stop in afterwards?
No. He didn't stop by the Gray household. Del Rey's interesting. You know, so you came up today and tomorrow. Our studios are here in Alexandria, Virginia. And everyone knows about Alexandria from the press and from the media accounts. But the actual shooting happened in a section of Alexandria called Del Rey. Now, we've talked about Alexandria before. This city has been rated the most liberal city in Virginia. And when you think about, you know, cities like Charlottesville, you know, it's pretty tough. But as a whole, Alexandria is the most liberal. We have a Democrat mayor. There's not a single Republican on the city council. It's overwhelming. It is as blue gets. And I understand that. I get it. And in Del Rey, I've called this before my little hippie commune, because it's the most liberal of the liberal. I mean, it makes the rest of Alexandria look positively National Review-ish. It's nothing but yoga studios, and it is as left as it gets. But I still love it. It's a cute town, and I get it. So, you know, what happened yesterday, it made me go back and think about something that I saw. My wife and I noticed this a few months ago. You know, after Trump was elected, the resist signs were big. And on the opposite, the park where this happens, a very big park, and on the opposite fence of this park where this tragedy happened yesterday, there was a huge resist sign. And it made me think about it yesterday. And there's resist signs. My neighbors have resist signs, and they're kind of all over the place. And so to go back to Trump's election, this is a picture I took yesterday. This is an emblematic picture of what's in Del Rey. After Trump was elected, these signs are everywhere in Delray. It says everyone is welcome here for people who are listening. It has obviously a Muslim-looking woman. The bottom says Hate Free Virginia. These signs are everywhere, and they were they're ostensibly an F you to conservatives because it's saying, hey, Trump won. You racists aren't going to win. And, you know, here's another sign that a picture I took yesterday in Delray. Hate is not welcome here. And it's all and the subtext is, of course, it came up after Trump's election. The subtext is, hey, conservatives, you're not going to get your way here, it, which is crazy because it's not like hate ever had a place in these businesses to begin with. I understand that the virtue signaling and whatever. But this isn't a place where, honestly, if I walked, I've walked around with NRA, our shirt right here, NRA TV, and NRA TV, NRA News hat. I've gotten looks before. That sign is not meant for me.
Right.
That sign is not meant for you. That sign is not. That sign is meant for them. And when they talk about you're welcome here, you're welcome here. If I walked into one of those places with a Make America Great hat, I would be thrown out of my ass so fast, or I'd be screamed at, or I'd be some next viral video. You know, how dare you come into our place? So this idea that the left, and it's really driving me crazy now because you're seeing all this stuff, and yeah, I get it. Tonight is a great thing with the baseball game, and, you know, Congress is all getting together, and it's all on the surface. Yeah, everyone's got to play nice. But under the surface, it's really not true, and that's what's really annoying me, and especially being in Delray. Being in the epicenter of what's going on right now, we're the biggest news in the world, especially in the United States. So yesterday, I'm walking one of my dogs, and there's a unity rally in Delray, starting at the town square you'd call it there, where they have the farm. By the way, where they have the farmers market, where every week Moms Demand has a huge tent.
Oh,
at the farmers market, and also by the way, next to this place where they had the unity rally start. There has been a sign, whatever day, June 2nd or something, for the Wear Orange Day. Mm-hmm. There was a huge professionally printed banner just attached to one of the fences in Delray because that's what you do there. I mean, if I'd gone there and put an NRA, you know, any sort of NRA propaganda paraphernalia, whatever you want to call it, that would have been torn down so fast. But Moms Demand every town, fine. You know, it's Delray. It's what you get. It's what they support.
They're inclusive that way.
They're inclusive. Yes, they're inclusive of each other. So they had this. They had this unity rally, and I figure, I missed the beginning of it. I saw they were all walking. They're walking to an Anglican church, which faces Monroe Avenue, which is the street where all this happened. Which is literally, you could like a 2-minute walk to the park. It's right there. It's the church, some houses, the YMCA, which everyone heard about yesterday, and the park. It's right there. With all the cameras, everything's, you know, you can't get past the church, you can't get past on Monroe Street, all the cameras, all the cars, all the cops, Red Cross. It's unbelievable how much equipment is there. So I go and I catch the end of it, and it's obviously people are walking away from it. They just had their unity march. And I see our mayor, Mayor Silberberg, who's as leftist as they get, and I see a bunch of Moms Demand shirts. Every town shirts, you know, lots of gun controllers there. And as I'm walking towards them, I hear some of these women, these T-shirts, they were just like, oh, God, I can't believe that guy's here. You know, it's so inappropriate. It's so uncomfortable. Why does he have to be here right now? Why? What is he adding to the conversation? And this is who they were talking about. A guy across the street holding a sign said, good guys with guns stand by you. All he was doing there was standing there holding a sign. He wasn't screaming. He wasn't yelling. He wasn't berating the women in their Moms Demand shirts, the men in their Everytown shirts. He was just there because he felt, rightly, because the good guys with guns stood by the members of Congress yesterday. Without those good guys with guns, it would have been much worse than what it was. So you have these people who are upset with this man holding a sign. I went to talk to him. Nice guy. Just wanted to say, listen, he appreciates how the Second Amendment protects people. He appreciates how guns protect people. And he just wanted to get that message across because obviously in Delray, and at the scene of the shooting, it's going to be a very, very seldom used message because in Delray, it's gun control. It's leftist. It's liberal policies. So I was thinking about it. And you have all this talk about unity. And this guy was just trying to say, hey, here's my point of view, you know? But they don't want unity with him. they don't want unity with me. They don't want unity with you. They don't want unity with this audience. They want to be unified with themselves. And that's what the thing that drives me crazy about this is because, you know, you talked yesterday about your silos and people in their bubbles. And listen, I know Del Rey is it's not typical America. I'll grant you that. It's very different for Topeka, Kansas. Fine. But everyone is, you know, all these people, they're paintings and they're putting up signs, love this and friendship that and no hate and tolerance. But if you have a guy across the street with a pro Second Amendment sign, we're done.
Right.
We're done with our tolerance. You can't. That makes me uncomfortable. You can't. How dare he? How dare he stand there with that message? That message of hate. So that's what I want to get across. I wish that I lived in a town where they really wanted to have unity and they really wanted to break bread with me and they really wanted to find out the mind of this man and talk to him. You know, at the Anglican Church, I forgive my religious ignorance. I don't know what the head guy, obviously he had
like
the
pastor,
you call it for an Anglican church. He obviously saw, and also, by the way, as soon as all these people complain about the sign, the still cameras, vroom, they're all over him. You know, and the guy was asking who they are. Getty, AP, you know, all the biggest photo agencies are there. You know, we gotta get a picture of this guy. You know, this guy, holy crap, he's holding up this sign. So the head of the church was obviously like, hey, the guy's just trying to do something nice. So he actually walked across the street, shook his hand, said some nice things to him, which is great. I'm sure his personal politics, I wouldn't imagine, aligned with that.
Right.
But he was obviously very, very he was nice about it. But that's the thing about this whole idea of, you know, we need to tone down the rhetoric and we need to be unified. It's so often a one-way street. And, you know, my little hippie commune of Delray, Virginia is very emblematic of that. And, you know, on a micro level. But as on a macro level, when you can't be unified with a man who holds up a sign thanking the people who had the guns to save the members of Congress, what can you be unified about?
But see, that's the thing. I mean, like, I think it's, as you say, they don't want to be unified with the people that they disagree with. They want to be unified as a community, right, which is fairly monolithic in thought and attitude. And in that respect, maybe not like a lot of other parts of the country. That's the unity that they want, right? They want to know, well, my neighbor came out and we saw, but they don't, you're right. They don't want that unity of, okay, we may disagree. You may be pro-gun and I'm here in my Moms Demand shirt, but you know what? We're all a part of this community and it's great to see you out here. I'm glad that we both care. Even though we might care in different ways, we might have different policy prescriptions. I'm glad that we both care enough to be out here, right? But that's, again, that's not the attitude. And it's really sad that you heard the sniping and the, oh, what's he doing here? But, you know, we shared this on, was it Monday's show? The woman in the Moms Demand action button in New York City at the Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar saying, you know what? It's fine to kill the president on stage. Everybody knows it's the theater. It's not really the president. As if that was the issue, someone would get confused, right? And I don't know what's going on here, but... That wasn't the issue, and it blew right by that because it made that woman feel good to go and see an actor looking like Donald Trump get stabbed on stage there in New York City, and it made those moms demanding action in Del Rey feel bad that this guy would interrupt their unity march, right? Now, think about that for a second. Their unity march. How could you have a... My unity march. If it's a unity march,
right,
it's our
right.
unity march,
there's
right?
No, there's no hour. That's the sad thing.
So, and again, this is why you can't, it is so frustrating, Cameron, you're right, because this is why you hear, like yesterday, again, all these hot takes, it's time for a conversation about guns. Can we have a conversation about guns? I'll give you an example of this. Mike Lupica of the New York Daily News. Republicans in Congress won't budge on gun debate, even when the bullets are aimed at their own. Yeah. He says in his piece for the New York Daily News, even though Representative Scalise was one of those hit Wednesday morning, it's actually by the grace of God that he was one of the players of the field because as the third highest ranking House Republican, he was the one with the around-the-clock protection from Capitol Police. Quoted Rand Paul and his comments on MSNBC. Mike Lupica said, maybe we'll learn more in the hours and days to come about what sort of madness brought this shooter to this moment. But what we already know already, and what the Republicans from Congress on that field know, is that he came to the moment with his guns. Maybe now we can have another debate about guns in America. It just won't change anything in Congress, even though the shooter was shooting at them this time. Again, this is exactly what I'm talking about. 800, 900 words on, can we please talk about this? Without actually saying anything. Now, why would we see so many of these columns that we need to talk about this? We have to have this conversation. And they don't say anything. They don't say, here's what we want to have. Here's what we want to do. Here's what the gun laws should look like. Why is that? Because they don't know? And if you don't know what those gun laws would look like, if you can't come up with that perfect gun control law that would have stopped this attack, well, then say that. Say, I don't know what could have been done, but I want to do something, quote unquote. That would be better than we need to, just the empty rhetoric of we need to have this conversation or we need to come together when we don't, we've got people who don't really want to come together. What they want is for us all to come together in agreement with them, right? And, you know, we were talking about this. I was talking about this on Twitter today. I was talking about Terry McAuliffe and his views on firearms, because he said yesterday that we got to do something to get the guns off the street. And you know what Terry McAuliffe did this year in Virginia was to tell people who were the victims of domestic violence, individuals who had taken out an order of protection against somebody, hey, we're not going to cut you a break. We're not going to let you carry your firearm concealed while you're waiting for your concealed carry license. We're not going to help you get training if you can't afford it. We're not going to do any of those things. There were two bills that would have done exactly that, that McAuliffe vetoed. And when he vetoed those bills, he said that, too many people think that a gun in the hands of someone, a victim of domestic violence, can make them safer. Obviously, he doesn't believe that at all. He must believe that then these individuals would be safer if they were disarmed. He's not calling for that. And the law in Virginia still allows these individuals to own a firearm, still allows the individual to openly carry a firearm without a concealed carry license. And after they get their concealed carry license, they'll still carry. Governor McAuliffe's vetoes did absolutely nothing to actually stop these victims of gun violence or these victims of domestic violence from having a firearm to defend themselves, even though he says that makes it more dangerous. But he couldn't allow these bills to get signed at all. He couldn't do it. Even though all it would have done would have been to allow these individuals who are already legal gun owners, who will soon have their concealed carry license in their hand, allow them who've taken out an order of protection, it would just allow them to carry concealed a little bit sooner. That was the bridge too far for Terry McAuliffe. That's the bridge too far for the anti-gun activists there. Right? That's where they want to find, and we're supposed to find unity with that. We're supposed to believe that that somehow is going to make us safer. It's ridiculous. But that's what they've got at the moment. I tell you what, we've got Jen Jakes from Bearing Arms standing by, so we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, we'll talk with Jen, Stephen Miller of Heat Street later in the hour. Stick around. More Cam & Company coming up next. Talking with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Ledee from the Armor for Troops Foundation. What is Armor for Troops all about? I mean, it sounds like it might be kind of self-explanatory, right?
We started this in 2005. We realized there was a lot of shortage of equipment overseas, so we started the foundation. We provide anti-ballistic eyewear, Under Armour, multifunction tools, knee pads, elbow pads, antibacterial clothing. You know, you don't, Marines and all military in the war zone don't shower for 2 or 3 weeks. At that point, only your mother will love you. But we provide equipment. We're doing boots, boot pads. We started doing some vests, but they got so expensive we couldn't do it anymore.
Wow, that's still an amazing amount of material that you all are able to supply free of charge to these members of the military.
The boxes we were standing them had a retail of $750. of all the stuff we put in it. In addition to all the equipment, we also put in batteries, toothpaste, toothbrush, disposable shavers, deodorant, clear eyes, lip thing. We had face wipes, hand wipes, foot powder. So we put a big box together.
That is fantastic. And this is all volunteer driven?
Yes, it is. We have zero salaries. Everybody is a volunteer, have been for over 10 years, and no one gets paid anything here.
And how many people have you been able to help since 2005?
Well, we sent out over 46,000 pairs of eyewear alone. So you got to say we've helped over 46,000 people. Doesn't count the thousands of Under Armour and multifunction tools, et cetera.
That is incredible. Was there anything like this when you were active duty?
No. And I did 31 years in the Marine Corps. So because of what was happening, especially going to a war zone, I remember what Secretary Rumsfeld said. You go to war with what you have, not with what you want. So we started figuring out that there was a shortage of things. We were going to do something that no one else has done. The military did offer equipment. We just gave them better, great equipment.
Remove the jobs. Break the schools. Pull back the police. Let the streets flood with drugs. Let violent gangs recruit child soldiers and terrorize neighborhoods. Don't prosecute gun crimes. And when the media looks you in the eye after another bloody weekend in a major American city, call for more gun control. If our politicians are truly using the carnage they refuse to stop to attack the rights of honest, hardworking Americans caught in living hell, then they are guilty of the most despicable form of racism imaginable. What has been allowed to happen in our inner cities is an absolute disgrace. If the same epidemic of poverty, gang violence, and broken schools poison the neighborhoods of the nation's political class, you'd better believe they'd be talking about real solutions, not gun control. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
It is the dream of the animal rights fanatics to suppress your most natural connection to the earth, to sell you a life filled with urban fascinations, to ignore that death is life's unwavering partner, together creating a relationship between predator and prey that makes it possible for us all to survive. To the hunter, this world's most honest steward, these fantasies are the poisonous, perverted manipulations of social misfits who would take this planet hostage. They should startle you and awaken you to trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, SiriusXM Patriot 125. An hour from now, David Ersani at the Federalist will be with us. Right now, our friend from Bearing Arms on Twitter at Jen Jakes, and right here on Cam and Company as Jen Jakes as well. Jen, how are you today?
I am doing well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm good. I appreciate you coming on the program. Can we talk about The View for a minute?
Oh, my. Or The Spew, as I call them.
Yes. And really, I think it's quite appropriate in this case, given that they're talking about the Second Amendment. Always a wild ride when the folks from The View start talking about the Second Amendment and guns. Take a look and a listen with me, Jen, and then we'll dissect afterwards, shall we?
Sounds good.
Okay.
He had an Illinois firearm ID card and a concealed carry license in that state. And in Virginia, the gun laws are very, very lax. They're very, very loose.
You know,
but law enforcement officers will tell you when there's more than one person that has a gun, it makes the situation more dangerous for them because they don't know who the bad guys are.
But you know what? More guns is not the answer. Because I live in New York State, I just want to say this one thing because it's personal, really. Yeah. Because I live in New York State and there are tight gun laws here, I take the subway, I take the bus. I walk around freely. If I was living in one of these states, open carry or whatever they are, I would never do public transportation. I'd be afraid that some guy on the subway would have a fit, just go mad, upset about somebody took his seat or somebody's mansplaining or what have you, and shoot somebody else.
Well, see, because it's easy to do.
I feel we follow the lead of other countries. I mean, if you look at Japan, there is almost no gun violence. In fact, it's like the chance of being killed by a gun are just the same as chances in the United States of being struck by lightning. It's like one in a million.
They don't have a Second Amendment.
They don't have a Second Amendment.
Right.
I feel very differently about that, though. When I go to states like Arizona, when I go to states like Texas, I'm not worried about law-abiding citizens carrying guns. They don't make me nervous. I feel much more comfortable knowing that if something happens, you have law-abiding citizens that have gone through background checks but have been trained.
Have you
but
been around know how to... people with guns?
No. All the time. No, I have. I
really?
Have been around a lot.
So have you been around with afraid people with guns?
I have, and you know, a lot of these people.
I don't believe you,
Jen.
I don't believe
you.
Because when somebody
I'm
shoots a
gun, I'm a conservative. They're very pro guns, pro Second Amendment.
Listen, I'm also pro. Listen, no, I have no
I have
problem.
A lot of
I'm
not a gun girl,
to you,
but I have a lot of
I am saying to you that when people start shooting, people tend to run. If other people have guns, it makes it very hard for the police to know who to shoot.
And they're more likely to hurt themselves.
Who to shoot because every civilian's got a gun at.
But the problem is if the Capitol Police weren't there, and the Capitol Police were only there because Scalise is there and he's the House Majority Whip,
yeah.
If they had not shown up, there would have been a massacre there.
But that's their job. That's their training.
But you live in a society where only the police have guns. That's called a police state. That is not the United States
that's
of America.
Not the police.
That is not the United States.
I don't know. Listen, the Second Amendment. Let's talk about the Second Amendment then.
Please.
Okay, because the Second Amendment is about a militia.
Gosh, don't you feel smarter, Jen? Oh, I can just feel my synapses popping. I think that means that I'm smarter.
It was like riding a roller coaster. I didn't know which way to look. At one point, I felt nauseous. It was just a crazy train, quite frankly. I mean, they went from Japan to Texas to a militia. These ladies,
right?
They're special.
Well, let's dissect that. Let's start with Japan here, because this is one of the common things that we're seeing from anti-gun activists now. Nobody wants to take your guns away. Right? Nobody wants to take your guns away. It's just about a few common sense.
But we should be more like Australia.
Gun safety laws, right.
We should be more like Japan.
Japan, right? Where gun ownership has never been allowed. Private weapons ownership has never been allowed. Going back to the time that they were a feudal society. It's going to be kind of hard to implement here in the United States. But there is this idea. I mean, that's what clearly a lot of the ladies, with the exception of Jedediah Bila, that's what a lot of the hosts of The View were wanting. That's their ideal world, right? A country in which we've somehow just managed to get rid of all the guns. Somehow. Like, they don't want to get caught up on the details of how that would work, Jen. They just, but why can't we be moving towards that direction?
Well, and somebody had tweeted yesterday as well, it's sad that the bad guy had a gun in the first place. good one. We don't call them assault vehicles, assault knives. We don't blame the tool. We blame the person. And look, nobody is saying everybody should carry a gun. There shouldn't be any rules. Just here you go, free guns, you know, like Pez dispenser. Here you go, a 9mm for you, whatever. Be smart. That's what we say. But as Jedediah said, look, being in a state like Texas or an open carry state in Wisconsin, I feel safer knowing that there could be a citizen in a place to help me defend my life and my children's lives should a police officer not magically be there. Look what happened in London on the London Bridge and, you know, in front of Parliament. And you have all these instances where even police officers are not armed to deal with terrorists or bad guys. I mean, bad things happen. Either they're carrying a machete, they have fists, they have baseball bats. It doesn't matter. Bad people will do bad things. Blame the bad people.
Well, and so then we get into this idea, as you say, of in order to make the cop's job easier, Jen, you should not have the ability to protect yourself. Because otherwise there's a possibility that you will still be engaged in a gunfight with your attacker when the police arrive, and they won't know who the perpetrator is and who the victim is. And so that could lead to more carnage, they say.
It'd be better
for you to just be unarmed and for there to be no possible armed response for the 3, 4, 8, 10 minutes it might take for police to arrive.
Right, and in my area, rural Wisconsin, it could take police up to 45 minutes to get to me if my two local police officers are busy. you know, and I have to wait for the local sheriff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the answer is not leave everyone defenseless because bad people will do bad things. The answer is, hey, you know what? Take a street encounters class or go through a concealed carry course and really learn what instructors are teaching citizens who have concealed carry permits, because we learn that in class. We learn to call the police, identify yourself, tell them what you're wearing, put your gun down, right? Be very clear. And if the police do get there before you're able to call in 911, you clearly put down your gun, follow the orders of the police officers and law enforcement on the scene, and you will be fine. Right.
I mean, this is just not. Yeah, this is not something that you actually see as a problem in self-defense stories,
in
stories of people that actually use their firearm for self-defense. There was a story a couple of days ago. I saw of a woman who came to the aid of a 82-year-old who had her purse snatched. And this woman, you remember the story, right? And she's a concealed carry holder out of Ohio, and she stops the purse snatcher. Police didn't have any problem figuring out who the bad actor was and who the armed citizen was in that case. And I cannot recall a story that we've covered in which that was the case, where the police showed up and like, we don't know who the good guys or the bad guys are. I hear that argument all the time, but I can't find any evidence that that's actually happening.
Right. Well, and again, if these people would, you know, and it's so sad because they have such a huge audience, but if they would just take the same amount of time that they do on their soapbox to actually go through a course or a class or whatever it is, and educate themselves. What are concealed carry permit holders learning, and what are the facts behind the responsibility of carrying a loaded weapon every day? Maybe they would have a little more insight and common sense into why we act the way we act.
Well, you know, Jen, I just had this thought here. So August, in your home state of Wisconsin, we're going to have the Carry Guard Expo. Maybe you could be their guide for the girls of the View, the women of the View. You could be their guide to the world of concealed carry.
Hey, I will invite anybody who wants to come and train with me at Wisconsin Firearms Training Center in Brookfield on Burleigh. They can come down there in August. I will meet you there. We'll set up a time. That's the place. I am more than willing to walk anyone through who wants to learn more. I'll put that out there.
There you go. Jen, as always, it is fantastic talking with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you. Good to be back.
We'll talk with you again very soon. Jen Jakes joining us here on Cam and Company. August 25th through the 27th in Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Wisconsin Center. That is the NRA Carry Guard Expo. Tickets are available now. Whoopi, Joy, just in case you're listening right now, want to learn a little bit more, feel free to attend the NRA Carry Guard Expo there in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But boy, howdy, there was a lot of just misinformation. I don't particularly find the uninformed chit-chat particularly entertaining, or I certainly don't find it enlightening. It would have been cool if amongst the panelists there had been perhaps one individual, Dana Lash, perhaps, a Julie Golub, Natalie Foster, Christy McMaines, Laura Karn. I mean, I could keep going on and on. It would have been nice to have somebody with a little bit of gun knowledge there to say, well, actually, right? Actually, it would have been, actually, you know, it would have been great to have somebody with law enforcement experience there, because they're talking, the women of the View there, they're talking about, you know, listen, somebody has to use a firearm in self-defense. When the police arrive, they're not going to know who the good guys or the bad guys are. As I said, I've not run across that situation in the armed citizen stories that I've seen, because these incidents are typically over fairly fast when you have the ability to respond with equal force. If you don't, if it's you, defenseless you, up against the armed attacker, well, guess what? Chances are that attack is going to continue until that force can be met with equal force. And you'll be waiting for the police to arrive. And it may be 3 minutes, and it may be eight. And if you live in a rural area, it may be 45. But a story like, there was a story out of Chicago last night. Concealed carry holder, attempted armed robbery, guy shoots at him, The concealed carry holder pulls out his own gun, fires a shot, and it's over. He then fled the area. He's cooperating with police, but he didn't want to stick around where the armed robber was, so he ran away. But that was over in seconds. This concealed carry holder went to the police and said, hey, here's what happened. It wasn't that the police rolled up on this scene, because it is going to take time for police to get there, and quite often that crime is going to be over with. The criminal's not going to wait around. This doesn't play out like a episode of Law and Order. Well, the first 15 minutes is the setup, and that's where the crime takes place. No, this can be over in a matter of seconds. That's why we say when seconds count, help is only minutes away. Because we haven't figured out the transportation technology that would allow us to immediately teleport to a scene of danger, or the scene of a crime, so that there can be an instantaneous police response. And frankly, as more and more law enforcement budgets deal with bigger and bigger cuts, saw in Illinois right now, they're looking at a $6 billion deficit in their state budget. That doesn't even account for the unfunded liabilities, for the pension funds. I think it's $130 billion. They're running out of money. They're not the only state. And the law enforcement budgets, which have never really recovered from the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, it's not like the staffing levels have ever gotten back to where they were a decade ago. They're getting ready to get hit again. You are already seeing major departments like Baltimore. Record number of homicides right now in Baltimore. They had 6 homicides the other night in Baltimore, Maryland. They're down about 500 officers from where they were 10 years ago. You don't think they'd like to have 500 more officers on the street? They can't figure out where the money's going to come from. We had that story in Dallas, Texas a couple of weeks ago. Priority one response calls in Dallas, they've got a 12-minute time, average time, to answer those priority one calls. Priority two, you got robbed, but you don't think the guy is still in your house? Nah, you could be waiting an hour, hour and a half, hour 45 minutes. It's not that the police don't want to get there. It's that they can't get there. So if we're going to have these, again, I'm happy to have a conversation with anybody. I'll talk with the folks from The View. I'll talk with Shannon Watts. I don't care. I'm happy to have a conversation with anybody. But it's got to be a real conversation about the real world that we live in. We got to get past the empty rhetoric and the stale talking points. We got to get past the vacuous and vapid calls for quote unquote common sense gun safety reform when you're not actually saying what it is that you want. You want to have a conversation about making this a society that we live in a safer society? Great, let's have that conversation. But the conversation can't simply consist of you saying, "Well, I want to make this society safer." Okay, let's talk about how we do that. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, Stephen Miller from Heat Street joins us talking about the media reaction to the shooting in Alexandria yesterday. Top of the hour, today's hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy, and more. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking with Mina Clear with NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim. I'd love to talk about Refuse to Be a Victim. It's a great program. Let's start with, what is Refuse to be a Victim, and why does NRA do it?
Right. So Refuse to Be a Victim was actually founded in 1993 by women. They were a request from them nationwide for crime prevention seminars. So that's why it was initially created. And then in 1997, it became co-ed. Essentially, it's a program that teaches methods to improve personal safety strategies by increasing awareness, avoiding dangerous situations, and preventing criminal confrontations.
And this has been a very popular program for the NRA, and you even mentioned that it was, first was women, and then enough of the guys said, hey, NRA, we want this information too, so it became co-ed. So why do you think it's so popular?
I think it just has a lot to offer. It's one of the few programs that the NRA does offer that doesn't really push firearms, and not everyone in the country is comfortable with that. And I think that outcry originally came from women, so it kind of gave them a whole other option of how to protect themselves if they're not comfortable carrying around a firearm to protect themselves, which is why I think it's such a popular program across the country for everyone.
Speaking with Mina Clear with NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim program. Mina, tell us some of the aspects of the program. What is it you guys do?
So we have over 8,000 instructors across the country that conduct different seminars. The seminars are about 4 hours long in length, where they go over all the different types of strategies that help you not be a victim of crime. So that's a big thing of what we do.
So the seminars are big. And what do you cover? What are some of the topics that you cover?
Sure. So some topics that we cover are going to be home security, travel security, different like physical security, so things that you can possibly carry on your person, and go over different risk factors of each one, so kind of like the pros and cons and what would be best for you. And we also go a little bit into cybersecurity as well.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. So we got home security, physical security, travel, and cyber, among other things. So let's quickly touch on a couple of those. Just give me some highlights of home security. What do we need to look out for?
So for home security, you're going to want to make sure that your house is properly locked, so it's secure. You want to make sure that your deadbolts are working. If you don't have any, go get some. You have proper lighting, so you can that kind of defers people from coming into your home if it looks like someone is there. So those are some of the big things to cover in home security.
How about when we travel? It's summertime. A lot of folks are traveling. What are some of the highlights from travel security?
Again, kind of going back to some of the things that we hit on in home security, you want to make sure it looks like someone is there and someone's home. You don't want to make it look like you're traveling and no one's there, because that makes you just look like an easy target.
Right. So what you say, like when you're in a hotel room or something like that.
Yeah. So okay. If you're in a hotel, you want to make sure you have all your items locked away in a safe, because, you know, there are people who do have access to come into your room. So that's something we touch on as well.
All right. And finally, what about cybersecurity? That's a big one.
Yeah, cybersecurity is huge, and it is ever-changing. That is one that we are continuously updating and posting things on the NRA blog about. So for that, we want to encourage people to make sure they don't have an easy password and they are changing it often, and also just being aware of where you are logging into things and when you're not, and also being aware of what kind of apps you're downloading and where you're actually when you're clicking on links, just being sure of where you're going to on those.
So what you're saying, your password shouldn't be password. Is that what you're saying?
They should be very secure. You should think about something that no one else will guess.
Very good. Speaking of Mina Clear with NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim program. All right, got a little more time. Let's touch on one more. How about physical security? That's a big one.
Yeah, physical security is huge. So we actually have a display table at each seminar that the instructor compiles for themselves. And it has different tactics that you can use to protect yourself. So some of the things we have out there are tasers, stun guns, personal alarms. So carrying those things around with you and kind of discussing the pros and cons of each one of why it could be a good fit for you.
I'm sorry, before we run out of time, how do we get more information about NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim program?
Yep. You can contact us at refuse@nrahq.org. Or give us a call at 800-861-1166.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. Sirius XM Patriot 125. We've got Sean Davis of the Federalist, David Arsani of the Federalist. Wow, it's the Federalist Power Hour next hour. Right now from Heat Street. Very pleased to have with us Stephen Miller on Twitter at Red Steez. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Cam, I wasn't sure this was video at second, so I'm a little hurried up. I don't want to turn into that viral guy with his kids running in the door, so I had to like get a shirt on and get all presentable for you guys. And so hopefully I'm doing okay.
I appreciate that. Yeah, you look fantastic. We only let Steven Cruiser go topless, so we appreciate you abiding by that. And I was on Twitter last night. I've been scarce on social media for the past couple months, because it just every time I get on after about 10 minutes, I'm like, oh, I hate you all. And so I haven't been spending a lot of time on Twitter, but last night I was on and I'm reading the New York Times editorial. I'm reading your response. And I got to tell you, Stephen, I mean, you were just full of righteous fury, directed at the editorial board of the New York Times. This was raw, just white hot anger at the sheer audacity of the editorial board there at the New York Times to just slip in something that is knowably false in their editorial, blaming Sarah Palin, blaming the right for the rhetoric in 2011, in order to deflect from what's actually taking place in this country in 2017.
Yeah, we on the right kind of fall into two categories when things like this happen. One is, you know, it's with the shooting with Scalise and on the congressional baseball field, it's, you know, the shooter himself is to blame. We can't go and, you know, blame everyone else, the individual. And then you kind of have the other side who's like, well, hold on a minute. And I'm kind of teetering onto that other side. And the reason is because you're seeing a clear, distinct pattern of violence and escalation. And this has been going on, you know, in the interest of time, I won't say it goes all the way back to something like Occupy, but especially since the election. It started on Inauguration Day with protests and riots in D.C., smashing windows downtown, torching cars of just happened to belong to an immigrant. And we've seen this just ratcheted up since Trump's election. And anyone who follows me knows that I'm certainly no fan of Trump. But the problem is that you're starting to see this get really serious. It's gone from, you know, celebrities doing mock assassination porn with Snoop Dogg assassinating Trump in a video, to Kathy Griffin holding his head up, to Robert De Niro wanting to punch him, to all of these things. But more importantly, you have the political left whose message is basically only Republicans want to murder everybody. They want to murder the planet. They want to murder everyone with their health care bill. And that goes back to Bernie Sanders himself. And in the last now month, we've seen two attacks by two guys who were politically motivated by Bernie Sanders, one of them who was a direct volunteer on his campaign. I don't blame Bernie Sanders, but I got to tell you, I'd love to see him on Meet the Press answering questions on why he decided to fundraise off Gabby Gifford's shooting in 2011 and why he has been made calls for Trump to condemn his supporters. I think that this is where the political left is. It's institutionalized violence now. They've supported it. I don't know what else they mean by resistance when they say resist Trump. I don't know what this means. You can't resist the laws he signs. So I also think Bernie himself has a lot to answer for with whatever he means by a political revolution. This is a man who's idolized the Soviet Union and idolized these Bolshevik revolutions of the early 1900s, and those revolutions didn't happen peacefully. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm teetering on cynicism and cynical partisan right now, but I don't know the other reaction to GOP Congress members being shot, which is where we're at. Plain and simple. It's not what the Washington Post said. You know, where both sides are being attacked, and you know, it's not what the New York Times said. GOP leadership members are now being targeted by politically active members of the political left.
Absolutely.
That's where we're at.
Well, and you know, so it's interesting because you're right. The Washington Times was kind of a pox on both houses, right? It's just horrible to see this on the left and the right. And you know, look, Stephen, you can find some toxic stuff out there on the right, I am sure. But as you say, it's not just about the social media postings or the Facebook feeds that we're seeing. We're talking about the, as you say, the institutionalized nature of this on the left, from cable television outlets to left wing media. You saw the reaction from Marcos Melitzis, one of the prominent left wing bloggers yesterday, basically saying, you know, they had it coming, right? That they were asking for this. That is a far cry.
You had Nancy Pelosi confirm that today. Nancy Pelosi, when asked at a press conference today about this great unity we're seeing, said she didn't know how this all started. It was when Republicans became the party of personal political destruction in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how long that lasted for Nancy Pelosi. It was less than 24 hours.
Yeah. Well, to Nancy Pelosi's credit, I'm not sure she remembers much about the 60s, Stephen. So.
Right.
Yeah. But it does.
The 1760s, of course.
but there is a difference. And during the Obama administration, I think you could go back and you could look at the institutional right. And again, maybe it's the difference between a Tea Party movement, which harkens back to the days of, let's say, civil disobedience against a government that wasn't listening to the American people, versus the resistance, which is about, you know, blowing up stuff and killing Nazis, right? There's a huge difference between the motivation of the French resistance and Tea Party patriots, if that's who you're looking for to, you know, sort of build your narrative around.
Well, and I think that you touch on a part of this that isn't being mentioned enough. I talked a little bit on our podcast, but part of this is the left isn't winning elections. So their frustrations are starting to boil over. They haven't won an election since basically Obama's re-election. They got blasted out in the midterms. They got, of course, they lost the presidential election. Everybody, including myself, thought that they were going to win. And now you're seeing these races, these House races, where they're just every race is now the next most important thing. The Georgia House race, which was, you know, supposed to go to Ossoff, and it turns out it's going to a runoff now. And so they don't have a lot of places to turn. And it's interesting you bring up the Tea Party, because when, you know, Republicans lost to Obama and they were kind of down in the dumps and they were at a super minority, they didn't take to the streets. They didn't smash people's businesses. Mm-hmm. They didn't target Democrat congressmen on baseball fields. They didn't wear, you know, masks and hats and threaten guys off college campuses to come and speak. No, you're not going to do that. And to prevent you from speaking, we're going to burn our own buildings down. What they did is they got organized. They got organized on a community level, and then they basically created the biggest wave in American history of taking back the House of Representatives. They did this through electoral process, and that's what we do in this country. We don't take to the streets, okay? And what you have is you have a message, especially, again, from Bernie Sanders, who's out there preaching, you must go out and you must get in the streets and you must, you know, march and you must do these things. And all it's led to them is becoming an increasing minority. Because what happened this past election is groups like Occupy and groups like Antifa and groups like Black Lives Matter, when they sat their butts down in the middle of a highway, they didn't teach anybody about social justice. They didn't make anybody learn their lesson. All people did was hit the gas pedal and go to the voting booth and vote Donald Trump. And that's basically where we're at. I think a lot of this is frustrations with the political left and the Democrat Party unable to win an election. Well, when your only messaging is your opponent just wants to kill everybody and you're killing the planet and you want to kill homosexuals and you want to kill women and you do this, you're not going to win with that message. What you are going to do is rile up your base to the point that it looks to me like guys are now starting to pick up guns and go shoot GOP congresspeople. And again, I know people are going to roll their eyes at this. I know people are going to look at that. No, but folks, this is where we're at. GOP members are being shot on a baseball field. When do we decide, and this goes again with how media enables this by romanticizing these kinds of movements like Occupy and Black Lives Matter, is when do we say that this is enough? Does somebody have to officially die? Does Trump have to be assassinated?
Well,
then? I don't understand.
Well, see, what they would say is that's a red herring. They would say that they've been demanding a change, and they've been saying that enough is enough, but they would say that the answer is we need more gun control laws, that it's not about the messaging, it's not about the political environment, it's simply about gun control, and that's what's going to stop stuff like this.
Right. I don't know how they think that they're going to get more gun control when people who supposedly hate gun control are using guns to target people who do believe in the Second Amendment, who weren't caring. Again, I commented on this again with the podcast, is the only reason that this wasn't worse was Scalise had his security detail and Capitol Police there at the field with him. Other than that, it wasn't like, you know, Jeff Flake and Rand Paul were out there, you know, shooting the baseball with their handgun. Okay. So I don't understand how they think that we're going to just suddenly give up the right to bear, you know, to give up the right to hold firearms when you're targeting us on baseball fields. That's going to make us want to carry guns more of the time. So this idea that Republicans had it coming, well, the people who are saying that, I don't think know just how strongly we believe in that right to protect ourselves. And we're going to protect that right no matter who gets, you know, no matter what happens, whether it's GOP congressmen being targeted, whether it's kids at Sandy Hook being targeted. I don't think that they understand that. And I do see a moderate part of the Democrat Party. In fairness to them, I do see moderate members who are starting to back off this gun control argument because they're not winning elections. You saw this with Omar Mateen in the Pulse nightclub, which we just had the anniversary of. You saw this narrative turn to gun control, and it was Republican hate. Well, these people can't even be honest about what Mateen's motivations were okay, this wasn't a gun control argument. This was a radicalized Islamic terror issue. This wasn't gun control. And until they can't be honest with these issues, I don't see an electorate as willing to be honest with them. You're basically, instead of blaming a kind of scourge of terrorism that we all kind of face in every country, you're blaming Americans' right to protect themselves. And Americans aren't going to vote for people as long as you're blaming them.
I think that's a fantastic point. And particularly when, Stephen, I don't know if you've noticed this either. We've seen, you know, an innumerable number of hot takes about we need to have a conversation. It's time for another debate. Can we talk about this now? And the entire column consists of the need to talk about it rather than actually proposing any actual solutions or policies, right? It's just this vacuous, well, can't we talk about this? But they really have nothing to say. They have no specifics. They have no law that they could offer. They sometimes you'll hear them say, well, we all know there's not just one law. Okay, well, then give me two, three, or four. Give me the package that you want to see. But don't tell me we need to have a conversation, and then you have nothing to contribute.
You're right about that. There's not a single law that would have prevented this guy from doing what he did. He purchased a firearm legally. He had a background check, despite what David Frum decided to go and vomit all over Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
He purchased this gun legally, and that he basically drove from Illinois to D.C., and he scouted this field. And then it was confirmed by a couple of congressmen that he did go up and ask, okay, who's on the field right now? Is it Republicans or Democrats? And then the Washington Post has the gall to go off and say, well, this was an attack on everyone. No, it wasn't. This was a targeted assassination attempt by somebody who was enamored with the message of Bernie Sanders that we need a political revolution in this country. And he's taken it upon himself to somehow, I guess, try to take back the Senate himself with a gun, because, again, the left can't win these elections on these issues. So that goes again to what you said. They don't have solutions to these problems. Right now, the Democrat Party is a party of tactics, not ideas. They don't have ideas on these things. And until they get ideas, until they start winning elections again, this is what we're going to see. Again, this is a pattern. This is a pattern of violence. This is not just one kook like it was with Jared Lee Lautner and Gabby Gifford.
Stephen, I got to leave it there. Unfortunately, we are coming up against a hard break. No, but listen, I do appreciate you coming on the program. I really hope we can talk again very soon. At Red Steez on Twitter. Stick around. We'll be back with more right after this.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes, until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, and so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience with firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. Gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carrying was where I learned the most.
The right responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can
always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of the scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times, and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running, when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check.
So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience. And I think it's great for someone that's coming in, and this may be the only class they take.
Made in America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of Cam and Company starts right this second here on NRA TV. Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. As I mentioned, a Federalist Power Hour with David Harsanyi. Join us in just about 20 minutes or so. Also, Sean Davis of the Federalists, who had a bit of an exchange earlier today with a reporter at NYC Jim, I believe it was, Jim Roberts. Jim didn't like the fact that he got something wrong. And look, it happens. People get something wrong. New York Times editorial board got something egregiously wrong. Jim just misidentified the firearm used by the attacker in Alexandria yesterday. When it was pointed out, Jim got really snippy with Sean. Well, excuse me, you guys keep talking about this. I'm just going to talk about the assault rifle the guy used. Because, again, apparently words don't matter anymore. Language doesn't matter anymore. It's all about the narrative. Doesn't matter if you are a reporter or a columnist or an opinion writer. It's all about the narrative. Washington Post, Petula Dvorak, with a column today. This country's real carnage comes from guns. It's time for Congress to change that. Okay, so again, is there a specific, Cameron, I haven't read this column yet. I'm just going to go through it. Let's make a bet. Is there a specific policy proposal contained within this column by Petula Dvorak at the Washington Post?
Oh, boy, this is a tough one, but I'm going to say no.
Okay, let's see. Somehow many of our lawmakers have decided that this is not the American carnage that they will mourn. No tears, no shock. Certainly no effort to do anything to stop it. Congressman is shot, and then they cry. Now, she writes, now is the time to finally stop pretending that immigrants or border walls or press leaks or coal jobs are a top priority for America. Nearly 7,000 Americans have already been killed this year by gunfire, she says. Every year, 22,000 people use guns to commit suicide, including veterans. This is the real American carnage, she writes, that Congress refuses to tackle. You want to make America great again, she says. How about we going back to being an America where my kids get fire drills, not active shooter drills at school? That would be great. But she writes, the answer from Republican lawmakers shaken by the shooting in Alexandria, more guns. No, there's actually no policy proposal. She quotes Representative Barry Loudermilk from Georgia, who said if this had happened in Georgia, he wouldn't have gotten too far, the attacker. I had a staff member who was in his car maybe 20 yards behind the shooter who was pinned in his car, who back in Georgia carries a 9mm in his car. He had a clear shot at him, but here we're not allowed to carry any weapons here. Dvorak says, seriously? We lost more than 33,500 Americans to gunfire last year. That's my entire hometown and the next town over. Gone. If Ryan is serious about, quote, an attack on all of us, it's time to find a real answer. America is better than this, better than bloodshed on a ball field on a summer morning. So she doesn't have the answer. She doesn't even have a suggestion. She doesn't even have like one or two things. It's another one of these columns. Let me tell you what, this is the easiest column to write. Somebody should do something. What should they do? That's not what my column's about. My column is about the need to do something. It's not about the something itself. And we've seen how easy it is to write this column because we've seen dozens of similar columns appear in local papers and websites across the internet. It's amazing how many people believe we need to do something, but none of them can actually say what it is that should be done. So that's great, Petula. I'm glad that you've decided that something needs to be done, but it is a damn shame that with all of your years of experience as a journalist covering issues like this, you can't come up with one single recommendation in your column for what should be done other than something. Again, you might not like what Barry Loudermilk had to say, but he had a specific idea, didn't he? Which is more than you can say for Petula Jevorczyk and the editorial board of the New York Times and so many others. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, our deal of the day. Good guy as well. Hero of the day from Florida, the Tampa Bay Times, Holiday, Florida. 33-year-old Newport Richey man arrested on Sunday night on burglary and battery charges after he allegedly punched a man several times outside of a bar in Holiday. The suspect, Stephen Blackwood, then ran away from the bar and tried to break into a home about a block away where authorities say he was shot in the shoulder by a resident. All started at the King's Seat Bar and Grill in Holiday, where Blackwood got into an argument with another patron. Tampa Bay Times says Blackwood then followed the man into the parking lot, reached into the open driver's side window of the man's car, punched him in the face several times. He also hit the man's side mirror, causing $300 in damage. The man in the car, fearing for his safety, grabbed a firearm and then ran away. Do you think the gun control advocates will actually note this guy ran away? Doubt it. Blackwood then ran about a block to a residence in the 3400 block of Woodcock Drive, where he tore through the back patio screen and then tried to enter the home through a sliding glass door. A woman who lived there heard Blackwood. She calls 911. Her boyfriend grabs a gun and confronts Blackwood on the patio. The man opened the sliding door, told Blackwood to, quote, get back. Blackwood then lunged towards the man and entered the home. That's when the man fired one shot, which hit Blackwood in the right shoulder. He was arrested at about 8 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, taken to a local hospital to be treated for injuries. Bail set at just $10,000. And I imagine Mr. Blackwood will soon be out on the streets. The total strangers who had a guy break into their home, they're okay and facing no charges because they were acting in self-defense, and they are your heroes of the day. Deal of the day comes from the Concord Patch in New Hampshire. A local felon with a lengthy criminal history is once again behind bars, they write, after allegedly flashing and firing a handgun in Concord late last night. 33-year-old Timothy Dearborn of Concord, arrested on June 15th, that'd be this morning, charged with felon possession of a firearm, reckless conduct, as well as unauthorized use of a firearm and criminal threatening. It was just before midnight, about 11:45 on Wednesday evening. Officers sent to downtown Concord for, quote, multiple reports of shots being fired. Witnesses reported that a man that they knew had allegedly flashed a gun and then began firing it. Police say he shot approximately 30 rounds from a 9mm pistol. Responding officers located the suspect walking north on Main Street in close proximity to where the shots were fired. He was immediately detained. They located a firearm, magazines, numerous shell casings along Low Avenue there in Concord. No reports of injuries. During booking and processing, according to the Concord Patch, Dearborn allegedly threatened to harm officers through verbal and physical actions. And the Concord Patch reports during the past 5 years, Mr. Dearborn has been arrested numerous times. Back in 2012, for example, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Dearborn was arrested on burglary charges after reportedly breaking into a gift shop to steal beer and into a storage shed to steal a Willy Wonka sweatshirt. Now you can say, oh, come on, it was a beer and a Willy Wonka sweatshirt. Not a serious crime. Shouldn't have gone to prison for years and years. You're probably right. 2015, he's arrested by Rockingham County Sheriffs for violation on burglary charges. He was actually in another county jail at the time that he was arrested on the burglary charges. He had been charged with public drinking in Concord at a local gas station. Again, minor charge, minor crime. Also arrested on alcohol charges again in Concord in May and September of 2015. And then when he was living in Massachusetts, he was arrested again on an additional burglary charge. 2016, he's living in Bristol, arrested on warrants out of Nashua District Court. Again, looks like it was a public drunk, arrested again in Concord on a warrant out of Bedford, Mass, on a theft charge. Then this year, arrested in Concord in late March on criminal trespass charges, default or breach of bail conditions. A few weeks before that, he had been arrested on a theft charge. In April of this year, he was arrested for disorderly conduct. He was also arrested the same day in Concord, Mass. He was arrested once in Nashua, once in Concord, 12 hours apart. Breach of bail charges, also arrested last month for indecent exposure and breach of bail in Nashua. So the crimes appear to be escalating, appear to be getting more serious, and also appear to increasingly be occurring while this guy is out on bail. He bonds out. He goes on to commit another crime. He gets arrested. He gets put in jail. Bonds out. While he's on bond, goes on to commit another crime. Warrants are issued for his arrest. Rinse, cycle, repeat. Throughout at least two states there for the 33-year-old, today's deal of the day. And our good guy of the day, also from the Patch website, Quincy Mass, Officer Ryan Donnelly. Patch says, in the right place at the right time. It was June 11th. He's driving on Route 3A in Kingston. And he notices a couple of motorcycles that have been pulled over to the side of the road on Route 3. He said he began to slow down. He saw a guy hanging off of a fence over the northbound traffic of Route 3. Ryan Donnelly, off work, but never really off duty. He is a crisis negotiator. He said he walked towards the man. He saw that he was upset and he was shaking. He was using his bare feet and hands to cling onto the fence. The man told Officer Donnelly that he wanted to die. He said he wanted to let go. He's going to jump in front of the next truck that he saw. Guy asked if he could have a cigarette. Wanted to talk. Didn't say he wanted to talk, but he wanted to talk. He didn't really want to let go. Officer Donnelly said, you know, if you crawl back over here, you can have all the cigarettes you want, man. We can talk. The other motorcyclist who had seen what was going on, he had stopped as well, just a good Samaritan. He and Officer Donnelly able to talk to this gentleman, help him back over the fence. Man taken to the hospital where he can get the treatment that he needs. The lieutenant, Dan Minton, with the Kingston Police, wrote a letter to the police chief, Paul Keenan. And he said, without the prompt and professional response of Officer Donnelly, the distraught man may have jumped before emergency response personnel could have intervened. So again, in the right place at the right time, able and willing to do the right thing and to save a life, off-duty Officer Ryan Donnelly of Quincy, Massachusetts. We thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. Still to come this afternoon, Mr. David Harsanyi at the Federalist raises the point if the killer or the shooter in Alexandria, Virginia, is responsible for his actions, and only he responsible for his actions, well, that standard should apply across the board, right? And not sure that it does, as a matter of fact. Also, later in the hour, Sean Davis of the Federalist, the New York Times, lies about gun laws to excuse leftist violence. And Vice.com with a story. Now, I'll be honest with you, I did not expect to see this headline at Vice. Extremism experts are starting to worry about the left. Brian Levin, Joshua Hertz writes for Vice, found himself in the spring of 2016 in an uncomfortable position trying to save the life of a Ku Klux Klan member. Levin was documenting a Klan rally in Anaheim, California, when a counter-protest suddenly took a violent swing, forcing Levin to physically place himself between a Klansman and a furious anti-fascist mob that seemed ready to kill. It made Levin wonder if his focus on the obvious subject, the white supremacists, meant that he had overlooked a growing source of extremism, the far left. He said, at that point, I said, we have something coalescing on the hard left. A move towards violence. Oren Siegel, the director of the Center on Extremism, which is an arm of the Anti-Defamation League, says, I think we're in a time where we can't ignore the extremism from the left. Vice reports the evidence so far is largely anecdotal that we are seeing a growing movement. Levin says since December of 2015, he's documented nearly two dozen episodes in California where political events turned violent because of agitation on both sides. He says something that's not happened before. Now, Vice says, there are violent clashes on college campuses involving groups like Antifa, the quote, anti-fascist group taking on the alt-right. By the way, again, I'm not going to fact-check every article from Vice, but let's back up for just a second here. First of all, Antifa calls itself an anti-fascist group. They also call everybody that they oppose fascists, right? Even when they're not. If they don't like you, all of a sudden you are a fascist, which is why they don't like you, because we're anti-fascist. It's this weird catch-22 self-perpetuating prophecy. Aggressive anti-Trump rally said, attended by members of the Redneck Revolt, a new pro-minority anti-supremacist group that encourages its members to train with rifles. Left-wing extremism, of course, they say is nothing new. Groups like the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers have deep roots in years after 9/11. Siegel says the largest source of extremist violence was from the left, eco-terrorists and animal rights activists. But he says those later organizations mostly targeted institutions. In the modern era, politically motivated violence perpetrated by angry lone wolf attackers bearing automatic rifles. Again, it's Vice. Yeah. For an organization that is so pro-Vice, they're so anti, like, facts about some stuff. It's really weird. They could tell you everything you want to know, Cameron, about how to, like, cook with marijuana, but they couldn't tell you the first thing about how firearms work. It's the weirdest thing.
I went to the Twitter feed, I went to @Vice, and this tweet was @Vice News. And the first thing I thought to myself was High Times Magazine, because what the hell else do they ever talk about? That's Vice News.
We've got Viceland on our satellite system, and every time I like scroll past it, it's like cooking with pot. It's like right. That's the show. It's cooking with pot or hanging with drug cartels. Like those are the choices that you get on Vice. It's the weirdest. I don't know who's watching. But whatever. In a recent interview with Vice News tonight, a chapter leader of one newly formed anti-fascist group called Redneck Revolt said the group has taken up guns only in self-defense. Chapter leader said, we are a response to a rise in politically motivated violence and intimidation against vulnerable communities. That doesn't mean we're like looking for a fight. We're just trying to defend ourselves. Well, again, there's nothing wrong with the idea of self-defense. There is something very wrong with the idea of deciding to wage war against your fellow Americans. Right? To say that this group or that group over there is so much an other that they are not a part of, in the words of Rahm Emanuel from a decade ago, they're not a part of the American family. Right? And so you can otherize them. You can view them as something that is not worthy of protection, not worthy of distinction, not worthy of the rights that we enjoy as Americans. And then you can do whatever the hell you want to them. That's a far cry from owning a firearm for self-defense. All right, we got to take a timeout, though. When we come back, David Arsani at the Federalist, Sean Davis of the Federalist later on in the hour as well. Stick around. We'll be right back with much more Cam and Company coming up.
Yehuda Reamer from Dallas, Texas, gave me a couple of copies of this book that he wrote for kids, Safety On, An Introduction to the World of Firearms for Children. So what made you decide that you wanted to do this?
I wrote the book because my parents were hounding me about being irresponsible, having two kids in the home. I grew up in Los Angeles, where thinking about guns are illegal, and I decided to write the book, and, you know, that's how it came to be, just to kind of tell my parents to leave me alone.
I love it. We're thinking about guns is illegal. So you grew up in L.A. I'm guessing you did not grow up in a gun-owning family. How did you get interested in firearms? How did you become an NRA member?
So I have a friend who's very big gun guy. He got me interested. Once I started learning about the Second Amendment and history and got into politics about 10 years ago, and that's literally how it was. I didn't grow up in a gun family. And my buddy just set me up with guns and never looked back.
That is awesome. And obviously, you care very much about your kids. We hear this all the time. We hear the gun shaming from the anti-gun activists. You care more about your guns than you care about your kids. I think it's pretty evident that that's not the case, Yehuda.
No, not at all. Gun safety is very important, and I do not want my kids learning about it from Hollywood, media, Matt Damon, those type of guys. So I decided to set out and write this book so that a responsible gun owner can teach kids about gun ownership and responsible gun safety.
All right, so what is in the book, Safety On, An Introduction to the World of Firearms for Children? This is a gun and a real gun safety book, right? This is not, hey, kids, owning a gun is cool or anything like that, right?
No, not at all. The book literally is an introduction to the world of firearms for kids. It touches base on, you know, making sure your guns are unloaded when you're not using them, finger always off the trigger, know your target, what's beyond it. Every aspect of the gun safety curriculum that kids need to know is in the book. Taking away that cool factor is in the book. Guns are not cool. They're tools. Use them as a tool. Everyone will be safe as long as you follow the proper safety guidelines.
Talking with John Nelson from the USA High School Clay Target League. So is the sport still growing as incredibly fast as it was the last time we talked with you?
Well, last year we had about 11,000 kids in our program. This year we have 17,000 kids that are represented by 615 high school approved teams.
That is amazing. How many states are you all in right now?
Well, we're currently in 15, which is three more than last year. And just in 2008, we started this program in Minnesota with just one state.
That's so cool. I mean, here you are, a decade later, 17,000 kids. What does it take to start a clay target team at the high school level?
Yeah, well, you can come to the league's website, which is usaclaytarget.com. You can either find your state or simply select to start a team. We provide a presentation information to help present to athletic directors and school officials to help get this approved as an activity in the school.
Do you run into opposition, or are people embracing clay target as a high school sport?
Well, once they understand the benefits of the sport, the how safe it is, affordable, close for families to participate, that school officials really become a little bit more knowledgeable about the sport and about the league. So eventually, as they do conduct their due diligence process, they understand what a benefit this is, not only to their schools, but their community, their families, and the kids, of course.
Absolutely. So if folks are interested, They want to learn more. Again, what's the website that they can go to?
Go to usaclaytarget.com, select your state, and you'll learn more about your state's league.
All right, and if we don't have a league in your state, you guys can help actually start one.
Hey, we only need five schools to start a state, so we have about 35 more to go, so let's go.
I think we can do that. I think so. I mean, look, we've got these junior shooting leagues. We know we've got instructors. We've got students that are interested, so I think it's only a matter of that time and that activism. And, John, thank you for all of your activism and what you're doing.
Thank you, Cam. Appreciate your support.
Absolutely, and we'll be talking more about the USA High School Clay Target League on Cam and Company. Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. I got a chance to do the NRA Carry Guard VR experience today. Got to say, it was absolutely amazing. My first time ever doing any sort of virtual reality stuff, which was cool enough. But the scenario that you were walked through, I got to tell you, it is absolutely compelling. Again, I'll remind you, the NRA Carry Guard Expo, NRACarryGuardExpo.com. Tickets are available for this event in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, August 25th through the 27th. You want to be there. If you have the opportunity to do so, you'll have the opportunity to go through your own virtual reality experience and learn a heck of a lot more about how to safely and responsibly protect and defend yourself. David Ersani, senior editor at The Federalist, is with us on the show right now. David, how are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. I'm glad to hear it and glad you could join us today. A piece, David, that should not be contentious, and yet somehow, in this day and age, it is. If the Alexandria shooter, you write, is responsible for his actions, and if he alone is responsible for his actions, then that standard should always apply. And yet we know, David, that it does not always apply. Sometimes motivations are important to the media, to the chattering class, and sometimes motivations are completely unimportant, right? Then we have to look at other things like the gun laws in this country.
Right. I mean, I think when something like this happens, and the coverage, I think, is fair and good and normal. You know, but I'm sure most conservatives think to themselves, if this was reversed, it wouldn't be this way. And, you know, after you're beaten down time after time, you know, you're maybe not as charitable as you should be towards others who have done that to you in the past. So I think that's an understandable instinct, and it would be nice if we learned a lesson here. And I'm not saying let's not politicize these events. If you want to argue over gun laws, let's argue about gun laws mm-hmm. and what could have happened. I'm saying don't create this, you know, don't try to chill speech. Don't try to blame people who haven't done anything wrong. I think that's what I'm more worried about, it because people who were writing me, I think, confuse my argument, and they think I want to chill speech in some way and debate. I don't. Talk about what you want. Just don't blame Sarah Palin for something she didn't do.
Well, that's that might be a bridge too far, certainly for the editorial board of the New York Times these days. And that's the thing. I'm with you, David. I love the First Amendment just as much as I love the Second Amendment, just as much as I love every other one of our constitutionally protected rights. And I want our rights to be robust. And that means that I'm going to hear things that I disagree with. I'm going to hear things I think are absolutely disgusting. I'm okay with that. I will deal with that, because I'm sure that someone out there thinks that what I say every time I open my mouth is absolutely disgusting as well. And I don't want to get shut up. I don't want to shut up other people. But there is that... there's the expectation that the editorial board of the New York Times or other institutions who tell us how much smarter, how much more responsible and professional they are compared to the average egg on Twitter, right, or the average person on Facebook, or the average citizen journalist on a blog or a website, they're better than those people. And today we got a slap across the face to let us know, no, they're not any better. They are perfectly willing to try to rewrite history in an attempt to make their side look and feel better about themselves.
Right. And, you know, they love to point to Donald Trump and say, look at civility, look at what's happened. Well, I think that Donald Trump speaks in a way that is probably pretty brutal and vulgar in a certain sense. But, you know, we've gone through 8 years where every position that a conservative takes is racist, is sexist. Everyone always goes to the intention and sort of smears people rather than ever taking them up on their arguments. And not always, but quite often, and not just by fringy bloggers, but actually politicians. I mean, it was Joe Biden who said something like, you know, to a black audience, that Republicans want to put you back in chains, or, you know, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not civil either. And that creates an atmosphere that makes people feel, you know, smeared all the time, no matter what they say. So, you know, that kind of incivility is also problematic. And I don't think that Democrats actually look at it that way. So, you know, it's something, you know, I'm starting to worry about a little bit, because it gets to a point where people can't even have a discussion anymore. And then you have crazy people out there who might get violent. And, you know, obviously I hope that that's not the case. And we should mention, political violence is extremely rare still in this country, certainly rarer than almost anywhere else. And I'd like to keep it that way.
Well, I would too. And hopefully, you know, you talk about it's getting harder to have a conversation. And I've been thinking a lot about this, David, because yesterday I was looking at this guy's Facebook feed before it was removed, and he wasn't really having any conversations with people. I mean, he was retweeting a lot of stuff. A lot of memes were, you know, reposted on his Facebook page, but he wasn't actually engaged in a lot of conversations, at least not online. I heard an interview with the former mayor of Alexandria, who would work out at the YMCA every day where this guy had been apparently hanging out. He would use their Wi-Fi every day for the past couple of months. And the mayor said he was always on his laptop, never really, always quiet, would sometimes, you know, nod or agree with somebody if he overheard something, but never initiated conversations, never actually did anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, you know, this guy clearly wasn't reaching out to anybody to have a conversation. He would much rather just attack the hypothetical or theoretical Republican terrorists out there on his Facebook feed. It doesn't sound like anybody's really reaching out to him either. It is so easy for us to ignore the people that we disagree with and the people that we don't want to talk to. I mean, like Shannon Watts is a perfect example of this in the gun control movement. She's so ban happy. I think it's because she can't ban any guns, David. She just, you know, blocks people on Twitter that she disagrees with. You can't have a conversation. I would love to have an honest to goodness, talking points free conversation. But I feel frustrated because I don't know that you can anymore.
No, I mean, I think that people have, you know, this gets into other issues like community and getting out there among real people. I know many people I disagree with that I know in the world, maybe because I grew up someplace where people disagreed with me. But I think with the internet age and with social media, it's easy to sort of compartmentalize your life and just listen to people you agree with. And then the people that you don't talk to, I guess you can start to dehumanize them in a way as well. Now, I'm not trying to psychoanalyze this guy. I don't know. I'm not, but, you know, that's not what I'm doing. But, you know, it's just a theory of mine that, that perhaps you dehumanize people when you hear that, you know, because they don't believe in climate change, they actually want to destroy the earth, or because they don't like Obamacare, they actually are trying to kill old people. I mean, that sort of rhetoric that we use in politics, and I think in a sense is okay. We that's just how people talk when they're debating. They get a little bit heated, they get a little bit dramatic. But some people out there will take those things to heart, and because they live in a world away from those political antagonists, they dehumanize them, and then maybe killing them is not, you know, as big a leap as it would be for other people, and they're already maybe mentally not, you know, there, and it gets to be a dangerous situation. I don't know. I mean, that might be part of it. I think community definitely is part of it, lack of community.
Yeah, no, I think that you're right, David. Listen, I do appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Without a doubt, it's kind of a troubling time. No, it's not just kind of. It is a troubling time that we're living in, and I don't know that there are easy answers on how to, you know, back away from the precipice, but as long as we keep talking, maybe there's a chance.
I hope so.
Me too. David Arsani, senior editor at the Federalist, with us here on Cam and Company. Meanwhile, in Georgia's 6th District, A letter going out to several neighbors of Karen Handel, the Republican who's in the special election coming up next Tuesday. Brent Scher at the Washington Free Beacon says police have blocked off Karen Handel's neighborhood after reports that letters containing a white powdery substance calling Handel a, quote, dirty fascist were left at homes of her neighbors. Says cops have been going from mailbox to mailbox after finding the suspicious package, according to local reports. A neighborhood resident posted a picture of the contents of the envelope. She told the Washington Free Beacon that several letters were distributed and that they contained white powder. The letter, I can't read it all to you, because it kind of sounds like, you know, well, you know how the left's like being all empowered by using bad words, apparently? Yeah. Apparently the letter writer kind of got into that, too. Your neighbor, Karen Handel, is a dirty fascist, but I'm sure you already knew that, the anonymous letter states. Take a whiff of the powder and join her in the hospital, you bourgeois, bleeper bleepers. Resist the fascist takeover, 5 exclamation points. String up the collaborators, 1 exclamation point. And then again, the white powdery substance, which... So far, does not appear to have tested and turned out to be anything toxic. But, again, coming on the heels of the shooting in Alexandria yesterday, obviously authorities are taking this very seriously. Karen Handel said this afternoon, we had some suspicious packages delivered to our house and to our neighbors containing threatening letters and a suspicious substance. She said we'll continue to coordinate with law enforcement as necessary. She was also targeted, you know, by this attacker in Alexandria. In one of his Facebook posts, wrote, Republican bitch wants people to work for slave wages when a livable wage is the only way to go. Vote blue. It's right for you. Handel said in a statement, I'm aware that the suspect recently made vile comments about me on social media. It also appears that the suspect targeted members of Congress specifically because he disagreed with their views. She went on to say, we should not allow our political differences to escalate to violent attacks. We must all refuse to allow the politics of our country to be defined in this way. She said, now more than ever, we must unite as one nation under God. It is incumbent upon all of us to work together in a civil and productive way, even when we disagree. And again, those are lovely sentiments that are not found anywhere in that anonymous letter distributed to Karen Handel's neighbors. And again, what is it with calling people you disagree with a fascist? What makes, I don't know, Cameron, sometimes I feel like I'm like picking up on the wrong things here, but it really does bother me. Like, if you're going to say this is what's motivating you, right? I'm Antifa. I'm anti-fascist. This is what I do. I get up and I write fascists all day. Okay, tell me why Karen Handel's a fascist. Because she's a fascist. I mean, like, no, there has to be more to it than this. If you're going to hate your fellow Americans with such a white-hot fury, please be able to explain it to me, other than I just think they're a fascist.
Well, that's what you said before, that I think Kevin Williamson at National Review wrote an article about this. It's gone from punch a Nazi to shoot a congressman. Because if you just say you're a Nazi, you're a Nazi. And that's it. You don't have to say anything behind it. The description is the reality, I guess, now. And his article sums it up perfectly. It's if you feel you have the right to punch someone who's a Nazi, then you feel you have the right to shoot someone who you feel is a Nazi or you feel is a fascist. And, we often ask, when does it end? I think we saw that yesterday.
Yeah, I think you're right. Couple of other things to get to. We got Sean Davis of the Federalist coming up here in just a minute, but Fox had a story earlier today about some of the professors in academia and their response to this attack in Alexandria yesterday. Daniel Blair, who is at Georgetown in Washington, D.C., physics professor, tweeted that he hopes Steve Scalise will rethink his A-plus rating from the NRA. Said, I wonder if Steve Scalise will rethink his A-plus NRA rating, hashtag thoughts and prayers do nothing. But you know what, Cameron? I understand that tweet by Daniel Blair has actually solved gun violence in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
Because thoughts and prayers don't do anything, but hashtags and tweets, holy cow, an amazing
hashtag
response.
Do something.
Yeah. Merv Emery, an assistant professor at McGill University in Quebec, retweeted a post offering, quote, thoughts and prayers for Steve Scalise. Quote, who accepted $18,500 from the NRA and wants more guns on the streets. That kind of response, right? Again, the only reason why someone like Steve Scalise could even have a pro-Second Amendment point of view is because he gets campaign donations. They say they want to have a conversation, but they don't want to listen. I got to tell you, I mean, as we sort of careen and ping pong towards the cliff here, that's one of the things that is most frustrating as somebody who talks for a living every day. I would love to have a conversation. I would love to talk about what policies, what proposals they actually want, but they don't. They don't want to have a conversation. They don't want to listen to you. I'm perfectly willing to listen to a gun control advocate. I would, if I want to. It's why I, tuned into Sirius XM Progress last night. It's why I'll listen to the left. It's why I'd like it if Shanna Watts would unblock me from Twitter so I could see what she has to say. But apparently she doesn't want me to see what she has to say. I'm not her target audience. She's not interested in swaying me. Not interested in getting my point of view. Not interested in a gun owner like me receiving her point of view. That's not what they're interested in. So why the demand for a conversation? Why the call for a debate if they're not willing to have one? I'm willing to listen. Are they willing to listen? I bet you're willing to listen, too. No skin off my back taking 10, 15 minutes to listen to what somebody has to say, whether I agree with them or disagree with them. That's great. I can do it. If they'll give me the same opportunity, I'll even let them go first. I'll just sit and listen. But I think there's, again, it's not both sides who are wanting that right now. And kind of like with a marriage, making a marriage work, you got to have two people who want to make it work, right? You got one person who wants to make a marriage work. You got one person who's like, let's just get divorced. It's probably not going to be a happy marriage. You got one side here doesn't want to listen to the other one. Probably not going to end well. All right, when we come back, Sean Davis of The Federalist. We always enjoy listening to what Sean has to say. Stick around. We'll be back with much more coming up right after this.
Here with our friend Ron Bellin from Reaper Outdoors. We've seen anti-hunting activists go out and attack everything from prairie dog hunts, hunting in Africa. Yeah. You know, you hunt hogs with knives and dogs. I can only imagine what PETA and HSUS would say if they heard about how you hunt.
Oh, they like us. They love us because then they have a job, because then they have something to complain about, which is the most primitive hunting in the world. Anti-hunters will complain about us using AR platforms because it's unfair. And then when you go chasing them like they did before guns were even invented and use knives, they'll complain about that. So they're just going to complain. They're just always going to be that type of person. And that's what's so cool about being here and being surrounded by like-minded people like you and myself. And, you know, if it's not for hunters, hunters are the largest conservation force out there today. They really are. If you want to talk environmentalists and take care of the environment, that's what hunters do. They pick up the trash. They thin the herd, if you will. They eat the meat that they kill. And the most organic meat on the planet is wild animals. So the complaints that we get, we are fighting it. We fight it up in Maine every year with the anti-baiting, anti-dog for bear hunting because they don't understand hunting, period. And also even dogs used for deer in the south. Southeast, it is a little different, but these clubs do a really good job. These are dogs that are trained to do what they do. The hog dogs take care of themselves, take care of the trainers, take care of them and the owners like you wouldn't believe. They care more for them than they do their families. I'm telling you, they get treated really well.
You know, and it's funny, you talk about how it doesn't matter what the tool is, right? The anti-hunters, they don't like hunting. That's what they're opposed to. It's not that they're opposed to hunting with an AR or hunting with a shotgun or hunting with a knife. They're opposed to you hunting. And yet, I mean, this is in your blood, Ron. You grew up hunting in Pennsylvania. You hunted to eat growing up. I mean, this is a part of who you are.
That's how we survived. We literally grew up with nothing. When I was born, my father looked at a map and he found out where the least amount of population was in Pennsylvania. And him and my mother bought 4 acres, borrowed the money from my grandparents, bought 4 acres, built a little log cabin, no running water, no electricity, and we had to pump water. Eventually, we did get a well to pump out because we had no electricity for a pump. And we used to get water from the stream. We lived in Alaska, dirt floor, one-room log cabin, and we gold mined up there, and no electricity, no running water, outhouse, and we lived off the land. And that's the thing, you bring up a great point with the anti-hunters will go to a store and they'll buy prepackaged meat, no matter what it is. And they'll bring it home and feed their kids the steroid injected whatever. I eat meat from the fridge as well. But a hunter will go out and eat the most organic. I keep going back to that. The most primordial thing is to go eat your own food. And there's nothing better or more satisfying than actually going out and getting your own food, packaging it, storing it, and feeding your friends and family.
Absolutely. Even in this day and age where, again, it's easy to go down to the grocery store and, you know, pick up a package of chicken or a package of beef or whatever. But to know that if you needed to, that you didn't need the grocery store, to prove to yourself that, yes, I can go out and I can do this. I mean, that feeling that you get inside, it's tapping into something that's primal. It's tapping into something that, you know, goes back as long as mankind has been around. We've been hunting. And so to be able to tap into that experience, I think is amazing.
It is. And it's satisfaction. Every time I make a meal at my house, it's satisfaction. I have 3 freezers because we do a lot of hunting, obviously. But we, you know, my friends come over and we have converted people that didn't even eat meat because they didn't want to eat steroid injected or whatever, and antibiotic injected animals. But then they come over and they eat wild bear. Like, wow. They'll eat wild boar. So now they're eating wild animal meat. The other thing we didn't touch on, but is there's a season for these animals. So it's not like hunters are going out and just killing animals at their leisure.
Right.
There's actual seasons and there's limits. And what that does is adjust these herds, because as humans are spreading out through this world and where our population is growing, we're impacting the environment that these animals live in. So we do have to control the population in a sense. Through hunters is a great way to do it.
All right, man. Listen, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. And, hey, Cam, like always, man, thank you for what you do for us.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Sean Davis of the Federalist joins us on the program right now on Twitter at SeanMDAV. Sean, how are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. I bet you're doing well. You've already ruined one reporter's day. Darn it. He would have gotten away with it if it weren't for you and those meddling kids, Sean.
Yeah, the thing about these shootings is, for whatever reason, reporters and journalists and media types, they cannot seem to figure out how to get their Google machine working before they start reporting on guns or gun laws. It's amazing.
The only thing that's amazing to me about it is the fact that it keeps happening. And this is like just part of the, I think, the inevitable response when there's a story like this. You know, the reporters are not going to get basic things right. And I'm aware of that. I won't say I'm okay with it, but I'm aware. I've adjusted. I expect that to happen. But like this guy, Jim Roberts, who had tweeted out a picture, supposedly a type of firearm that the shooter used in Alexandria, got it wrong, tweeted out an AK-47 when this has been identified as an SKS. You and many other people pointed out he got it wrong. And to be fair, Sean, not everybody was saying, hey, Mr. Roberts, I think you might have made a mistake. Because, again, we've seen this happen so many times before. What I thought was really curious was Jim Roberts' response, which is basically, okay, smart people, you keep talking about this, and I'm going to keep calling this gun an assault rifle, right? I mean, like, there was a rejection of knowledge on the part of a reporter, which to me is pretty unusual.
There was. He aggressively rejected it. I think his response was, okay, well, you people can quibble about, silly facts, but the fact is that he used an assault rifle, which he bought legally. And so I responded to him, no, that didn't happen. Words have meanings. You are a reporter in the word business. He did not have an assault rifle. An assault rifle, Cam, as you and your audience know, has a very specific definition. It's something that's capable of select fire, fully automatic or burst. If the guy had a fully automatic assault rifle, that would be new, especially if he had one that had been legally obtained. So then I went through and explained to Jim Roberts, formerly a New York Times reporter, naturally, about how the term is actually really important and why it's a big deal when you get it wrong, because we have two totally different legal regimes for assault rifles and non-assault rifles. And his response to that, again, was just glib rejection, like, oh, okay, whatever, guy. And the problem is they have no credibility anymore. We know how they feel about us, and we know that they have no interest in getting the facts right. They've kind of let the cat out of the bag. We want to ban scary guns. All guns are scary, so therefore we have to ban all guns. And if you try to correct us on semantics or facts, we're just going to pat you on the head and be like, oh, that's cute. You care about these little cosmetic things. It's a big deal, and it's a big deal that they keep getting wrong.
Well, but as you say, it's not a big deal to them, because to them, there is no difference, right? It all falls under the rubric of guns I'd like to ban. Right. And that's, I mean, really, at the end of the day, that's what a quote unquote assault weapon is, or increasingly journalists will just use the phrase assault rifle. That's what that phrase means. It means gun I want to ban. And so it could be, you know, anything and everything. What's been, I think, kind of disturbing to me is, you know, go back like even a year ago when you would see this, Sean, and I kept thinking, man, I wish the media would just hire somebody. If every network had one or two people who just had a background, who knew about this stuff, boy, wouldn't that be great? And now, you know, it's sunk in. That would be great, but they're not interested in that. They're not looking for those resumes. They don't want reporters who actually know and have this background. I don't know if they don't want to hang out with them in the newsroom. I don't know if they think it would be a good fit, or if it really is just they're not interested in covering this these types of stories factually, that is less important to them than advancing a narrative and having a reporter or a journalist out there who could do a good job of advancing their narrative. But no, I don't expect this to change now. I have no expectation that things are going to get any better in the media.
Oh, I totally agree. That the thing that I find really interesting is how they respond. So these are people who pass themselves off as experts. They know the real facts. They know what's going on. They went to elite schools. And even if they don't happen to be familiar with the typical subject, why, you know, they are tough reporters. They can pick up the phone. They have great contacts. And if they don't know the answer, they can get someone on the phone who does have the answer. Unless the topic is guns. I mean, despite the fact that, you know, tens of millions of people have these things, that we have an active duty military full of millions of people who know how to use these things, these reporters somehow cannot manage to pick up their phone and dial a single person and just say, hey, I'm going to shoot you some language. Tell me if it's right or not. So it's not just that they themselves are ignorant. It's that they are aggressively protecting their own ignorance to the point that they will not go out and seek an opinion from someone who knows what they're talking about. They are content to let their ignorance stand as long as their ignorance supports a particular narrative. And for them, the narrative always goes in the same direction.
Talking again with Sean Davis of the Federalist. And you know, to this end, Sean, New York Times, obviously a Pulitzer performance with their editorial today, lying about Sarah Palin, trying to make her culpable for the shooting in Tucson, Arizona in 2011, eventually issuing a correction saying, okay, there's no evidence to tie that to Sarah Palin. But they left that entire paragraph still in this New York Times editorial that also, Sean, these editorial writers have decided, you know, it's people like Sarah Palin and it's the gun laws in this country, right? They don't have any specific solutions. They don't have any specific suggestions as to how the gun laws should change. But clearly what we have right now, according to the New York Times, is not working, and therefore, quote unquote, something must be done.
It's almost like they have a dartboard on the wall with a whole bunch of reasons for every bad thing that happened, and they threw it today, and they're like, oh, Republican rhetoric, okay, well, that caused this, and then they throw another dart, oh, gun laws, okay, that caused it. I mean, the fact that they went back and dredged up this disgusting, vicious lie that they peddled in 2011, that a mentally ill man who literally thought grammar was a government mind control operation was somehow influenced by Sarah Palin having a map of congressional seats she wanted Republicans to win. So the New York Times lie was actually twofold. They had the first lie that, number one, what Sarah Palin said or did was violent, insightful rhetoric. And then the second lie on top of that was that this nutcake who thought grammar was a mind control conspiracy had somehow consumed her rhetoric, and then that forced him to act. Both of those were lies, just abject, blatant lies. And so when the New York Times came out this morning and issued this fake apology, they didn't actually apologize for the full lie. All they came out and did was say, oh, well, technically there was no link established between the guy and Sarah Palin's hateful, insightful, violent rhetoric. Had they actually been intellectually honest, of course they wouldn't have published the article. But if they were honest, they would have retracted the whole thing and admitted it was based on a false premise, a lie that they concocted 6 years ago to smear Republicans. It's unconscionable to me that they keep getting away with this little game. They have been doing it for decades now.
And I imagine, Sean, they're going to continue doing this. I mean, that's the thing. There's no desire to change. In fact, I think there is an increased desire to do more of this and to see what you can get away with. And I'm curious, do you think if there had not been that immediate and very vocal reaction to the New York Times editorial piece, included by people not like you on the right, who I think the New York Times, look, they'll dismiss you, they'll dismiss me. But when somebody like Chris Hayes says, oh, guys, this is wrong, I think that actually played a role. I'm not sure if that reaction hadn't come from some members of the left, if the Times wouldn't have simply left this editorial alone.
We'll never know because they're never honest about how and why they publish what they do. I suspect, being a cynic, and I know that that'll shock you that I'm a cynic, that their lawyers took a look at it and said, you know what, this is actionable against us. We just defamed Sarah Palin with a claim that our own news pages have debunked. We should probably back out of that a little bit. My read is that it was a legal CYA consideration, and it had really nothing to do with them worried about criticism of their journalism that started on the right.
So where do we go from here, and how do we best push back? Is what we saw last night, is that an example of how we push back against this type of media malpractice?
It absolutely is, because what the media is trying to do now is they're trying to create two different castes. There's their caste, and they have their own rules for themselves, but then they have rules that only apply to Republicans or gun owners or conservatives or Christians. They want a separate rule for us and a separate rule from them, and the rules they apply to us don't get to apply to them. It's why they can blame Sarah Palin for what happened in 2011, but don't get to blame Bernie Bros or Democrats or progressives for what happened yesterday. They've crafted a double standard where we have to live up to the high one, and they don't have to live up to any. The best thing we can do is fight back to that and say, no, we're not putting up with this. You are going to live by your own rules, or you're going to live by our rules. But you don't get to pick and choose. You don't get to give us one set and yourselves one set. And if you're going to craft these rules that make us look bad, we're going to use them back right on you and wrap them around your neck. They're going to be an albatross around your neck if you decide that these rules apply to Republicans but no one else.
John Davis of the Federalist. Listen, sir, I appreciate you coming on the program. We are unfortunately almost out of time, but I know we'll be doing this again very soon.
Thank you, sir.
You bet. Sean Davis, again, on Twitter, at SeanMDAV. All right, just a couple of minutes left here on this edition of Cam and Company. In Australia, you know, where they had those Hillary Clinton, I won't say approved, gun control laws, because she said we should take a look at what they did in Australia. And you hear from the gun control advocates all the time, you know, Australia, they had their gun ban and their buyback, and then they haven't had any problems since then, right? It's been peaceful. Cameron, even the giant spiders and the crocodiles have stopped eating people in Australia since the gun control
laws. Wow.
I know. It's amazing. And yet, in Australia, they're getting ready to have a new national gun amnesty. Oh, I would think if the last gun control laws worked, they wouldn't need to have more. But apparently they need to have more. Justice Minister Michael Keenan will announce the details of the three-month amnesty running from July the 1st. He said, clearly the fact is we've got a deteriorating national security environment. We've got an environment where there's been five terrorist attacks on our soil. And sadly, in the vast majority of those cases, it has been an illegal firearm that's been used. Clearly, that makes this top of mind and why we want to make sure that we can clear as many illegal firearms from the community as possible. So remember that talking point that I just mentioned, right? No mass attacks in Australia since the gun ban. Well, that's not a good enough metric, apparently, for the Australian government. Because they're saying, listen, we still have terror attacks and people are using illegally held firearms. What's the answer? They say more gun control laws. I got to tell you, I think they're looking in the wrong direction if they're trying to stop terror attacks in Australia. But that is the direction that they're going. And unfortunately, the music means we're heading out the door. We're out of time today. But we'll be back tomorrow, live 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV, midnight Eastern on Sirius X and Patriot 125. We'll see you then.